You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan, in his semi-annual testimony before the Senate Banking Committee, Greenspan said, "We are creating a problem that has to be addressed." He created a stir when he agreed with Democratic campaign statements that there is a growing gap in wages based on skill level. Greenspan said that upper-level income households have benefited more from the economic recovery than anyone else. He said the effect of increasing concentration of incomes is not desirable in a democratic society. While the Democrats blame President Bush's tax cuts for the disparity, Greenspan blames education.
Pilot salaries at Delta Airlines took a major nosedive on Tuesday after the union was forced to increase its proposed wage cut from 13.5% to 23%. And Delta says that still may not be enough to avoid filing bankruptcy. The airline posted its worst financial record in 25 years and wants pilots to take a 30% cut in wages and, quote, increase their productivity.
On Monday, the U.S. Justice Department gave $500,000 to a Mexican and U.S. coalition for use in fighting the importation of underage sex slaves in Southern California. The Bilateral Safety Corridor Coalition is made up of more than 70 member organizations in both San Diego County and Tijuana, Mexico. The coalition says that young women and boys are lured from Latin America and Eastern European countries to Mexico. They are then trained and sold. Many times they are sent to work in hidden brothels on farms throughout San Diego County where they are forced to service the workers.
Was Dick Cheney doing business with terrorists? Federal prosecutors will put that question to a grand jury this week as they subpoena documents from oil services giant Halliburton regarding its Iranian operations from 1995 through 2000. Cheney was the chief executive at Halliburton during those years while Iran was under sanctions for supposed ties to terrorist activity. Halliburton is facing at least 5 separate investigations for illegal corporate conduct, including bribery in Nigeria, also while Cheney was chief executive.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. According to the Non-Governmental Bureau of National Affairs, unions won 58% of the 1,348 government-monitored workplace elections in 2003, the highest success rate for unions since BNA began watching them some 2 decades ago. Fewer union elections overall were held in 2003 compared to the year before, meaning that while the success rate is growing, the actual number of electoral victories are declining. This corresponds well to shrinking union membership rates in the overall workforce.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Think you're not involved in your community? Think again. Spending your money with local businesses is more than an economic choice. It's a way you can have a say in the look and feel of your hometown. By creating a demand for local goods and services, we can ensure a place for the independent businesses that help give our communities character and keep them unique. The American Independent Business Alliance encourages you to get involved. Support your homegrown businesses. Find AMIBA online at amiba.net.
Take the A-Train. Ride that Wabash Cannonball. Hear the clickety-clack of the Orange Blossom Special. Trains are more than a part of our history. They're a rich part of our culture. But are they a part of our future? I'm not talking here about the enormous potential of long-distance trains. Upgrading Amtrak and building a top-of-the-line high-speed train system between our population centers. Rather, I'm focused today on the promise of rail travel within our metro areas. I've ridden these local systems in the Bay Area, Chicago, Washington, D.C., and elsewhere. They're simple, handy, efficient, fast, inexpensive, and a joyous way to get to where you're going. They also move hundreds of thousands of people a day without creating traffic jams or smog, and they create thousands of good jobs at good wages. Here's what one observer says. Mass transit is an excellent substitute for roads. These are not the words of some anti-auto earth-firster, but of Paul Wyrick, an icon of right-wing thinking. To him, urban train systems make all kinds of sense and are a legitimate focus for federal, state, and local spending. Public demand for these systems is strong. Ridership is up 21% in the last 5 years. New systems in Dallas, Denver, Salt Lake City, and elsewhere are exceeding expectations, and there's a backlog of 200 local transit projects seeking federal matching funds. There's the problem. The Bushites, tagged by Wyrick as the most anti-rail administration in our country's history of mass transit, is trying to gut federal support. In their zeal for fiscal conservatism, writes Wyrick, they are prepared to scuttle one of the most successful government programs of all time. This is Jim Hightower saying, Missing the Train, a new report by the Sierra Club, highlights projects in Tampa Bay, Portland, Houston, Milwaukee, and elsewhere endangered by Bush's cuts. Get a copy, 202-675-7915.
LendingTree.com presents How to Get Out from Under Debt. First, take an average guy.
Hello.
Then add some credit card debt, a car payment, and a student loan.
Ow.
To get out from under all this debt, get a debt consolidation loan from LendingTree.com, where banks compete and you choose the loan that's right for you. Call 1-800-555-TREE. That's 1-800-555-TREE. When banks compete, you win at LendingTree.com.
Equal housing opportunity. Some restrictions may apply. See website for details.
38%.
46%.
42%.
I cut my payments in half.
How much can you cut your monthly student loan payments by refinancing with College Loan Corporation? To find out, just call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. You'll quickly be connected to an expert loan consultant who will answer your questions and tell you how you can cut your monthly payment by up to 50% by refinancing your federal student loans at rates as low as 2.63%. 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, the report is out, sort of. The other half of the story, you know, it's funny, they reported the other half of the story that we're not hearing. It's funny, they reported this early on. This was maybe, what, 3-4 months ago? I don't think it was even that long ago that the commission said, you know, we're going to split our report. Yeah, the 9/11 commission, of course, we're going to split our report into two parts. The first part is going to deal with the failures in the intelligence community, you know, how they got things wrong. And the second part is going to deal with how the White House harassed the intelligence community, what role the White House played in shaping and influencing intelligence, the Office of Special Plans that Doug Feith had set up in the Pentagon, and Rumsfeld, you know, and Wolfie. And all of this shaping and molding and shifting and changing, we'll deal with that in the second part of the report. And that will come out after November 2nd. What a surprise. But the report is out now, and of course the preliminary evidence is that the Bush administration is going to be very happy because they are going to say, and, you know, certainly there are things in here that raise a number of issues, but mainly they're going to say, you see, it's all the CIA's fault. And we got rid of that nasty George Tenet that Bill Clinton had appointed. See, it's all Clinton's fault. That's going to be their talking points. Just, you know, very straightforward, ignoring the fact that Hans Blix, before the United Nations and the world, a week or two before George W. decided to declare war on Iraq, Hans Blix was saying, you know, we're getting unprecedented levels of cooperation. I'm sure you remember, maybe you saw, I watched him on TV say this stuff. It's just, you know, very unprecedented levels of cooperation, that they were showing up in places that clearly people were not expecting them. I mean, they were finding, you know, guards sound asleep, whatever. And that 100% of the sites that Rumsfeld and Cheney and Bush had claimed, this is where it is, we know it, Colin Powell before the United Nations. Here's the pictures, right? Satellite photos. 100% of those sites that the administration had pointed to before the United Nations had been investigated and found to have nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction. And so now Hans Blix wanted to go to, like, you know, the second kind of phase of the investigation. Let's look for stuff that might be, like, really well concealed. But it's really pretty obvious that there's nothing out here that threatens the rest of the world. And that's why. That's why the rest of the world was saying, you know, we're not ready to go to war yet. And it just amazes me to hear the right wingers, on talk radio and on faux news spinning this thing. Well, you know, the whole rest of the world thought he had weapons of mass destruction. No, the rest of the world was rapidly coming to the conclusion that maybe he didn't. You know, Saddam supplied 11,000-12,000 pages of documentation to the UN of where he got his weapons of mass destruction from. You know, like back in the 80s when Rumsfeld was supervising the sale of it to him, or in the 90s when he did $87 million worth of business with Halliburton. And the Bush administration went into the UN and said, you can't have that. Took the report, took it back to Washington, D.C., blacked out about 4,000 pages of it, and then said, okay, now you can look at it. And still, there was, you know, no evidence. Well, all that stuff will be dealt with after the November elections by the 9/11 Commission. So right now, it's all, you know, hugs and friends. And there's this very well-planned three-part Republican smear campaign that has been going on ever since John Ashcroft, under oath, lied to the 9/11 Commission, as has been demonstrated. He came out there and basically, you know, they were getting ready to say, hey, you know, Mr. Ashcroft, you were the attorney general for 7-8 months before 9/11 happened. How come your FBI, you know, we've got all these reports from FBI agents that you did not want them investigating terrorism. You wanted them investigating Tommy Cheech or Chong, whichever it was. You wanted the FBI to be looking at pornography on the Internet. But not terrorism, explicitly. And he heads them off at the pass. I mean, it was a brilliant political move. He goes in and he says, in my opening remarks, blah, blah, blah. And he talks about this wall between the FBI and the CIA. And instead of mentioning the fact that his own assistant had written a memo early in 2001... actually suggesting there should be a wall between the two, he blames Jamie Gorelick, a member of the 9/11 Commission, for writing a memo that he says caused or created the war. And actually, her memo, when you read the whole thing, rather than just the few sentences that he had taken out of it, you read the whole thing, her memo had actually said that, you know, going back to the Watergate abuses, that there had been these attempts to not have the FBI and CIA talk to each other, and really that wasn't such a good idea. We needed to figure out a way to make them talk to each other, and it was an attempt to take down the wall. But Ashcroft completely mischaracterized it. Step one, you know, shift the blame from Bush to Clinton. Gorelick was a Clinton appointee. Second, of course, you know, go after Sandy Berger. Sandy Berger is the guy. I've met Sandy Berger. He told me this story. Me and about 10 other people. It was a private press meeting in Washington, D.C. This was 6-8 months ago. And he told us the story of sitting down with Condi Rice on the day that they were doing the transition as the Bush administration was coming into power. and saying, your number one concern is going to be Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. The Clinton administration had made five separate attempts to assassinate Osama bin Laden, including throwing missiles into the training camps in Afghanistan, you know, hiring hit squads. I mean, five different assassinations. They'd all failed. And he said, you need to continue this. And she's like, well, I don't think so. So now, you know, of course, they're going after him. Kill the messenger. That's the mantra. If you can't deal with the message, kill the messenger. You know, the reality is, I mean, even the cons are acknowledging nothing is missing with regard to what Berger apparently walked out of the National Archives with. They were copies. Just copies. And the whole thing about stuffing stuff in his clothes, it was made up by somebody on right-wing radio. And it's been repeated so many times, some people are actually starting to believe it. Didn't happen. It's a lie. And then, of course, the Joe Wilson. Now let's go after Joe Wilson. This op-ed in the New York Times a couple days ago. Yes, apparently Iraq was looking for uranium in Niger years ago. But the president had said recently. Anyway. So now they're saying, oh, look at this. Joe Wilson, he's a liar. Sandy Berger, he's a thief. You can't believe these guys. Therefore, don't look behind the curtain. Don't look at that man behind the curtain. You just don't look back there. Don't ask about Doug Feith. Don't ask about the Office of Special Plans. Don't ask about Dick Cheney showing up at the CIA every few days, hassling the intelligence analysts. Got anything on Iraq yet? Got anything on Iraq? Don't ask about George Bush taking Dick Clark off to the side and saying, get me something on Iraq. Don't ask about that. No, we got to change the subject quick, they're saying. But it's a pretty straightforward thing. I mean, you know, looking at the 9/11 Commission and looking at what happened with the 9/11 Commission. I mean, in the beginning, of course, first of all, on February 4th, 2002, it's what, 3 months after 9/11, Dick Cheney calls Tom Daschle, the Democrat, the Democratic Senate leader, to, quote, warn him, according to Newsweek magazine, not to open hearings into the attacks. If Daschle pressed the issue, Cheney, quote, implied he would risk being accused of interfering with the mission against terrorism, end quote, from Newsweek. And no matter, you know, the 9/11 families, bipartisan senators and congressmen, they're all saying, please, please. That was in February. It took a year. November 27th was when George Bush flip-flopped on this thing and said, okay, go ahead and do it. I mean, he really had no choice. He was being so heavily pressured. He says, go ahead and do it, but let's put Henry Kissinger in charge of it. He did a really good job of covering up things for Richard Nixon. Yes, I know he's under indictment as a war criminal in five or six other countries, but, you know, and with Pinochet and all that. But that doesn't matter. We're going to put him in charge of it. A month later, Kissinger pulls out. Then they put in Tom Keene, the Republican governor of New Jersey, former governor. He asks for an extra $11 million. The White House says, nope, sorry, you can't have it. January 2004. Bush and Denny Hastert opposing a two-month extension of the commission so that they could finish their work. 2 months later, they said, well, we'll give you 60 days. They flip-flopped on that one. Alberto Gonzalez trying to manipulate the commission, you know, calling Commissioners Fred Fielding and James R. Thompson just before they gathered on March 24th to hear the testimony of Richard Clark, saying, after the calls, Fielding and Thompson presented evidence questioning the former official's credibility. Right. Trying to set it up. And on it goes. On and on. By the way, new information about the Saudi flight. Senator Frank Lautenberg just released this yesterday. It'll get buried in the press. I got to tell you about this one, too. It's a fascinating news day. Tom Hartman here with you, 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is a small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
I'm sorry. There's nothing more we can do. No one wants to hear those devastating words from a doctor. But that's what millions of Americans suffering from diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and diabetes will be told if you vote for Ralph Nader. Americans who voted for Nader put Bush in the White House in 2000. As president, George W. put the brakes on embryonic stem cell research, which could lead to revolutionary new treatments and cures. John Kerry vows to push this research forward. George W. Bush is still taking orders from the religious right. He wants to stifle stem cell research. This time, don't help him. Don't vote for Ralph. The Committee for the Advancement of Stem Cell Research approved this message. It was not approved by any candidate, nor any candidate's committee. Visit CASCR.org.
At last, there's a positive focus on a condition that affects millions. Read The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. John Rady, author of User's Guide to the Brain, says this about The Edison Gene.
Once again, with tireless scholarship and a bit of poetry, Tom Hartman helps take us to the edge of knowing ourselves, our brains, and our world.
The Edison Gene, available in bookstores everywhere.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. 20% of Iraq veterans who were in at least five firefights are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, according to a new study by the New England Journal of Medicine. PTSD is debilitating, causing headaches, sleeplessness, hypervigilance, and depression. The disorder has plagued a total of 12.6% of soldiers returning from Iraq, and the chances of suffering from it only increases with the amount of time spent in combat zones.
How can contemporary America possibly compare with 1933 Germany? Find out in Tom Hartman's brand new fully illustrated book, We the People, A Call to Take Back America. Through Tom's concise political analysis and Neil Cohn's vibrant illustrations, you'll observe an unsettling, if not shocking, perspective of America. You'll also hear what the founders of this country did to control corporate power. You'll be invited to consider how the American political system can be made more democratic, as well as comprehend the project for the new American century's vision for America. Here's what syndicated cartoonist Ted Rawl said after reading We the People.
An ambitious effort to explain everything that's wrong in America, how things got this way, and what should be done about it. We the People is the product of a brilliant and principled thinker.
We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman, available in bookstores everywhere.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I ain't lived forever, but I've lived enough. And I've learned to be gentle, and I've learned to be tough.
And welcome back.
I found only two things that last till the end.
Oh, this is really true.
One is your heroes, the other's your friends.
Welcome back. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And we've got a Rumsfeld torture alert coming up. The The guys in Afghanistan. Can you imagine a couple of guys sitting around in, say, Texas, and they say, you know, let's go over to Afghanistan, set up a private prison, and torture people. That sounds like fun. I got a little money in my savings account. I think I'll do that. Yeah. And Frank Laudenberg has released some fascinating information about the bin Laden airlift. We'll get to that. Let's go to the phones first. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Good day to you, Tom.
Thank you.
I just wonder sometimes, you know, when you see what's going on in our country, whether it kind of reminds you of a Marx Brothers movie. I see Gordon Liddy yesterday talking about what a terrible criminal Samuel Berger is, and then I see Christopher Bond from the Senate poo-pooing the Joe Wilson-Valerie Plame thing by saying, well, they were so traumatized by that, they posed for Vanity Fair, you know, and I'm thinking, well, this is a typical Republican tactic of excusing criminals like Gordon Liddy and Oliver North, you know, and making them talk show hosts and just completely poo-pooing the fact that somebody in the Bush administration divulged a CIA agent's name, which is a crime, possibly even a capital crime.
Yeah, it's a, if it's treason, you put him up against the wall and shoot him. Here's the proof that this is totally political. Let's just look at one guy, for example. The House Government Reform Committee chairman, you know, who's like, you know, the arbiter of appropriate behavior, right? Thomas M. Davis III. He's a Republican from Virginia. And yesterday, he says what Sandy Berger is alleged to have done, nobody knows for sure what it is, quote, a disturbing breach of trust and protocol, and says his committee will soon begin an investigation into the matter, despite CBS News reporting that law enforcement sources say they don't expect any criminal charges will be filed, right? So the FBI says, you know, we don't think there's a crime here. This guy's going to investigate it. The same guy in 2003, when he was asked by reporters if they would look into the leak of Valerie Plame's name, as you point out, a felony, possibly a capital crime, treason, the same guy, Thomas M. Davis III, the Republican from Virginia, chairman of the House Government Reform Committee, says, quote, I know Ashcroft very well, and I'm sure he'll go by the book in the investigation of this. He had his spokesman claim an investigation into the administration leak, quote, should be conducted by career FBI agents. He's refused to undertake a probe into Vice President Dick Cheney's office. He has now admitted coordination of federal contracts for his former employer, Halliburton, even though the emails from Halliburton have shown up saying, you know, this is being coordinated with the vice. So it's like anything happens on the Republican side, nah, it's not a problem. It's not a crime. What? Sandy Berger did something? Oh, we're going to nail him. Yeah, you're right, Rick.
And, of course, this goes for their moral issues, too. I mean, we've got a certain talk show host, which is on right now on certain stations, who's been divorced three times, admitted drug user. I mentioned Liddy and, you know, Gingrich, this great arbiter of morality, has been married three times now. We had Bob Barr paying for an abortion, even though he's very much a pro-life man.
As did George W. Bush when he was young, by the way.
Well, I have a conservative friend of mine who tells me that he's got stacks of material proving that George Bush and Dick Cheney are actually pro-abortion and pro-homosexual. Now, even I find that hard to believe, but he says he's got the documentation, and he's a conservative. You know, there are honest conservatives out there. You're just not going to see them on the national talk shows on radio or television.
Yeah, that's a fact. The Republican Party is getting rid of them quickly. They call them rhinos and push them under the rug. Rick, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. Good point. It's the Tom Hartman Program, 29 minutes past the hour. This is the true People's Radio. For more than 27 years, the Progressive magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. Author and broadcast personality Studs Terkel calls In These Times his bi-weekly tonic. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. 1-800-827-0270.
pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan, in his semi-annual testimony before the Senate Banking Committee, Greenspan said, "We are creating a problem that has to be addressed." He created a stir when he agreed with Democratic campaign statements that there is a growing gap in wages based on skill level. Greenspan said that upper-level income households have benefited more from the economic recovery than anyone else. He said the effect of increasing concentration of incomes is not desirable in a democratic society. While the Democrats blame President Bush's tax cuts for the disparity, Greenspan blames education.
Pilot salaries at Delta Airlines took a major nosedive on Tuesday after the union was forced to increase its proposed wage cut from 13.5% to 23%. And Delta says that still may not be enough to avoid filing bankruptcy. The airline posted its worst financial record in 25 years and wants pilots to take a 30% cut in wages and, quote, increase their productivity.
On Monday, the U.S. Justice Department gave $500,000 to a Mexican and U.S. coalition for use in fighting the importation of underage sex slaves in Southern California. The Bilateral Safety Corridor Coalition is made up of more than 70 member organizations in both San Diego County and Tijuana, Mexico. The coalition says that young women and boys are lured from Latin America and Eastern European countries to Mexico. They are then trained and sold. Many times they are sent to work in hidden brothels on farms throughout San Diego County where they are forced to service the workers.
Was Dick Cheney doing business with terrorists? Federal prosecutors will put that question to a grand jury this week as they subpoena documents from oil services giant Halliburton regarding its Iranian operations from 1995 through 2000. Cheney was the chief executive at Halliburton during those years while Iran was under sanctions for supposed ties to terrorist activity. Halliburton is facing at least 5 separate investigations for illegal corporate conduct, including bribery in Nigeria, also while Cheney was chief executive.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. According to the Non-Governmental Bureau of National Affairs, unions won 58% of the 1,348 government-monitored workplace elections in 2003, the highest success rate for unions since BNA began watching them some 2 decades ago. Fewer union elections overall were held in 2003 compared to the year before, meaning that while the success rate is growing, the actual number of electoral victories are declining. This corresponds well to shrinking union membership rates in the overall workforce.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. It's the calm. The storm is going to be November 2nd. In the ballot box. You know, hopefully we'll see. And hopefully we'll have an election, right? This administration, you just never know. I mean, it's absolutely never know. So we've got a Rumsfeld torture alert. Yes. 3 American adventurers who claim to be part of a super secret Pentagon task force. A Pentagon task force? Yeah, a Pentagon task force. They went on trial Wednesday in Kabul yesterday. In Afghanistan, charged with torturing 8 men in the private prison they were running in the Afghan capital. The leader of the group, Jonathan Keith Adema, former Army soldier, says his anti-terrorism unit, this from the Knight Ridder newspapers, released today, So his anti-terrorism unit was directly sponsored by Don Rumsfeld's personal office inside the Pentagon. Here's these guys, these three guys. They go over to Afghanistan. They set up a private prison. NATO cooperates with them. The NATO military commanders cooperated with the group on at least three missions, believing they were a legitimate Special Forces anti-terror unit. And this guy, in the first day of testimony yesterday, as they're dragged before this court for torturing, I mean, we're talking really torturing. You could argue whether, you know, putting hoods on people and forcing them to masturbate in front of a camera is torture, or, you know, holding them underwater until they almost drown. But these guys were like, you know, electric shocks. Well, all the details we don't know. But this was what we do know is that this was really serious, hardcore, heavy-duty, real torture. And this guy says, not that the other stuff isn't, but, I mean, you know, there's degrees. This guy says, Nadim of 48, he's from Fayetteville, North Carolina. And I quote, "The American authorities absolutely condoned us and absolutely supported us. At times, we were in touch with the Department of Defense every day at the highest level." Now, what's the highest level of the Department of Defense? Don Rumsfeld. "At the highest levels, sometimes five times a day." Army Lieutenant Colonel Barry Venable, a Defense Department spokesman, responded, "This group of three American citizens on trial in Kabul does not represent the American government, and we do not employ or sponsor them." Remember how the Mission Impossible program, those of you who are old enough to remember that when it was on TV, always started out, you know, the director, should you decide to take this mission, the director, and if you are caught, you know, blah blah blah. If you are caught, the director will deny any knowledge of your existence. And the tape self-destructs. Well, I wonder if these guys were told up front that if they were caught, they would be dropped like a hot potato. Or if they really, because here they are, they're coming out and saying it. So you have to assume, I mean, you know, either they've betrayed their mission. Either they were told up front, okay, go over there, torture people. So this gets back to this issue we were raising yesterday. Are we a nation of laws? Are we going to live by the rule of law? Or do the ends justify the means? And 100% of the time, when you have a government, or for that matter, a business or an individual, or any kind of institution or, you know, or any person who operates on the assumption that the ends justify the means. Doesn't matter what I do because what I'm doing, because they say, it doesn't matter what they do because the goal, the mission that they're trying to reach is such a noble one. Yeah, it's okay if a few people get killed along the way. Adolf Hitler was trying to create 1,000 years of peace in Europe. A new form of Christianity. He's renew and revive Christianity. Of course, it required him to get rid of everybody he didn't think was a Christian, which included the Jews, the communists, the trade unionists, the Catholics. But, you know, after they were all dead, there would be peace, I guess. But then if anybody dissented, well, you kill them too. Yeah, hey, more peace. Come on, guys. When a nation says the ends justify the means, you have, you know, when an administration begins to behave on the assumption and the doctrine that the ends justify the means, you have something that goes beyond corruption. This is a particular and uniquely human form of insanity. Speaking of the ends justify the means, We're still not sure what the end here is. But it appears that it's preventing embarrassment of the Bush family's multi-decade, multi-billion dollar relationship with the Bin Laden family. This just out, brand new, this is from the Washington Post, published yesterday afternoon, article by Dana Milbank. Frank Lautenberg yesterday released the manifest of the people who flew out of the United States. And what's interesting about this, the most interesting thing, I think, in this news report, is not just who the passengers were. I mean, we had Osama bin Laden's two of his brothers. And one of them was actually under an FBI investigation for terrorism. And, you know, I mean, okay, Michael Morris told us all about that, right? And not just Mike, 60 Minutes has told us about that. But here's the thing that I found really interesting. The plane was owned by DB Air and operated by Ryan International. So Ryan International is the company that was the charter operator, right? They rented a plane. And the tail number of the aircraft was N521DB. N521DB. So you can track this plane back. You can see, you know, who's been using it. Turns out it's the exact same airplane that during his 2000 campaign for the presidency, George Bush had leased for the press to fly in as they followed him around the country. And was continuing to be chartered by the White House after Bush became president. It was George Bush's plane. Seriously. Ron Ryan, the owner of Ryan International, a group that was leasing it, he said the bin Ladens, quote, were quite concerned for their safety, which alarmed the crew. Then he says, quote, the Saudi embassy offered to pay more money if our crew had a concern. But he said all were reassured because the FBI and Secret Service were heavily involved. They were in abundance every place we were. Among other passengers, notes Senator Lautenberg, new information just out, other passengers was Osama bin Laden's half-brother, Shafiq bin Laden, who was attending the annual investor conference of the Carlyle Group, which, by the way, was also being attended by George Herbert Walker Bush. Can you imagine if Bill Clinton's father was still alive? I mean, he had died when Clinton was very, very young. I don't remember all the details, but he was gone, and he's dead now. But if Clinton's dad was still alive, and Clinton was the president, and his father had been meeting in, was it New York or Washington, D.C., one or the other? Yeah, in Washington, on 9/11, with the brother of Osama bin Laden, as the country was attacked by Osama bin Laden. Much like this is why, you know, the conspiracy folks have so much fun with this family. And remember the guy who shot Ronald Reagan, John. I'm drawing a blank on his last name. Anyhow, his family was meeting with one of George Bush's brothers at the time that their son, John, was shooting Ronald Reagan. So, add this stuff up, and it gets very strange. It gets very strange. Anyhow, 142 people, mostly Saudi nationals, 6 chartered flights, One of them actually left before commercial airspace had been reopened. And Senator Frank Lautenberg says, and I absolutely agree, George Bush needs to explain to the American people why his administration let that plane leave. Another one of the people on the flight, Omar Awad bin Laden, a nephew of Osama, had been investigated previously by the FBI because he had lived with Abdullah bin Laden, a leader of the World Assembly of Muslim Youth, which the FBI suspected was a front group for terrorists. A couple of the hijackers, by the way, lived just a few blocks from the headquarters of the World Assembly of Muslim Youth, run by Omar Awad bin Laden, nephew of Osama, who was on this airlift flown out of the United States by George W. and company right after 9/11. Right after 9/11. So I just find this stuff fascinating. In the interesting trivia department, a former teacher of U.S. President George Bush on Friday questioned his qualifications as president in an address to foreign reporters in Japan. This guy used to teach at Harvard. And he's speaking at the Foreign Correspondents Club of Japan in Tokyo. City University of New York professor Yoshihiro Tsurumi said, quote, "I always remember two groups of students. One is the really good students, not only intelligent, but with leadership qualities, courage. The other is the total opposite, unfortunately, to which George belonged." He says, George Bush can no longer be reelected on the basis of his quote-unquote leadership. He was Bush's professor at Harvard Business School. And he said this to an audience. Right? He recalled a conversation he had with George Bush soon after he met him at Harvard. He says, "I asked him, what have you been doing? How about Vietnam?" Keep in mind, this was in the 60s during the Vietnam War. And George said, I'm quoting the professor now, "Well, I've been in the Texas National Guard." And I said, "How'd you get that? There's a 10-year waiting list." And he said, "Well, my dad has connections." He goes on to say, "In my class, he," that is Bush, "declared that, quote, people are poor because they're lazy," end quote. And the professor says, George was opposed to labor unions, Social Security, environmental protection, Medicare, and public schools. To him, Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal was socialism. Well, there's a lot of conservatives still believe that. And, you know, they're not going to tell you that. Because, there's this funny thing. In a democracy, you vote for the programs that you would like to have. If the majority of we, the people, decide, you know, we really want to live in a world where when you walk out your front door, you don't confront a bunch of begging, leprous children, as is the case in, for example, India or Bangladesh. We'd really rather not live in that kind of a society. We'd really rather have a social safety net, just, you know, for selfish reasons, if no other, just so, you know, the quality of life. Or maybe because, you know, our religion says that's what you should do, or whatever. I mean, there's a lot of good reasons that you can justify this. But the most bottom line selfish one is a fine one. We just, you know, we'd rather live in a world where we don't have to confront the horrors of extreme poverty. So we're going to put into place a Social Security system and a medical system and a minimum wage. We'd rather not have people explain, "Oh, that's socialism." You know, a few millionaires sit around going, "They're going to take some of my money to make that happen. I don't think that's right." And, it's technically it's not. Socialism is when the government owns the means of production and supply, and it's not the case. Although some would say, well, okay, it is. But it's called democracy is the bottom line. If we decide collectively, we the people, this is the kind of world we'd like to live in. We really would like to have a compassionate nation, as so many of the other countries, developed countries of the world, have decided. We'd like to have that too. We'd like to have that quality of life, and we're willing to pay for it. We're actually willing to pay for it. You know, Bill Clinton had a balanced budget. He even generated a surplus. We're willing to pay for it. Then. That's democracy, my friends. Not in the world of George W. Bush, but in the world of America, I believe it is. 10 minutes before the hour.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242-8272.
Hi, this is Tom Hartman. Join me this October as we explore Greece, the ancient birthplace of democracy. When the Founding Fathers were searching for the best and fairest form of government, they studied the models of Athenian democracy. We'll explore together this part of the ancient world where the ideas that today animate modern democracy were first worked out. This journey is set on the shore of the sparkling Mediterranean Sea with the sacred mountains of Crete behind us. We'll visit the ancient site of Gortian, famous for the Law Code of Gortian, large 6th century BC tablets of stone built into a wall and one of the first examples of laws ever written down, and now the oldest still in existence. I'll teach workshops at the two most important sites in all of Crete, Knossos and Phaistos, plus more. At Knossos, we'll experience the main ceremonial center and the palace of King Minos. For information on how you can join us on this trip of a lifetime, visit www.tomhartman.com or call 1-800-234-TOUR. That's 1-800-234-TOUR, T-O-U-R.
Tom Hartman will be joining the exceptional faculty of The Great Rethinking, The Prophets Oxford, taking place the weekend of September 10th through 12th at Oxford University, England. You are invited to join Tom Hartman in Oxford, along with other leading visionaries, including Vandana Shiva, Helen Caldicott, and Rupert Sheldrake, among others, to rethink and reshape our collective future. The Great Rethinking Oxford premise is that this tumultuous time in our human history may be crafted into the birthing of something truly new. And you can play your part in shaping this new worldview by joining Tom Hartman September 10th through 12th. To find out how, go to the website greatmystery.org. That's greatmystery.org. Together, we will make a difference.
Spring is coming earlier to mountains in the western United States, and that leaves nearby farmers with less water in the summer. I'm Richard Hoops for Earthwatch Radio. People in the western United States rely heavily on water that comes from melting snow in the mountains. If the snow melts slowly during spring and summer, it provides a steady supply of water that can be trapped in reservoirs and used later for irrigation. But these days, more of the snow melts early in the spring, and that could mean low water in reservoirs later in the year. Philip Moat is a climatologist at the University of Washington, and he's studied changes in mountain snowpacks during the past 50 years. Moat says the reservoir systems of western states are not managed to trap the runoff early in the spring, and if there's less snow to melt later in the year, there is less water in the reservoirs for people to use. Moat says this situation is likely to continue. Climate predictions suggest that annual snowfall in the mountains will decline in the future, and that the snow will melt even earlier in the spring.
Those predictions are very much in line with what we have been seeing in the last 50 years. So it's not simply something that's going to happen sometime in the distant future. It's already happening. Water resource managers, agencies, and businesses are just beginning to recognize that these changes are taking place and to begin to think through what it will mean to live in a world where water is in increasingly short supply simply because we're losing the dominant form of storage, namely snow.
This trend is particularly noticeable in Northern California and in the Cascade Mountains of Oregon and Washington. This change in climate could have serious consequences for the regional environment and economy. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Sea Grant Program and the Gaylord Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin.
democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. The dangers of dyslexia. No, I don't. You know, I don't mean to pick on people with dyslexia. It's a fairly common condition. And interestingly, a friend of mine, Ron Davis, wrote a book called "The Gift of Dyslexia." He's dyslexic himself. He traveled around the country and checking out yellow pages, found people who actually make a living as sculptors. There's not a lot of them. I mean, there's, you know, like a few hundred in the entire country. And 100% of them, he discovered, had dyslexia. So, I mean, there's apparently an upside to dyslexia. You can look at a block of marble and see David in it, you know, as Michelangelo did. But George Bush apparently has dyslexia. I mean, we hear this from multiple credible sources. And certainly dysphonia, you know, the inability to speak clearly. Probably dysthynia, whatever, you know, I'm not sure what the word with that for that would be. But anyway, it's letters. And it's starting to look like maybe he mixed up N and Q. Maureen Dowd points out in the New York Times today. She says it's starting to look like that the gangsta rap thing, you know, with Ali G. And this is going to run on Sunday on HBO. He's interviewing Pat Buchanan. He's a phony gangsta rapper. And he's saying, what about those BLTs in Iraq? And Buchanan says, well, you know, I think maybe we still will find those BLTs or whatever. So last year, he interviewed James Baker III, the guy who says that when he was in Russia last year, he said, I'm the guy who fixed the election for George W. Which was true, by the way. He was down there in Florida. And he says, is it a wise thing for Iraq and Iran to have such similar names? Isn't it a real danger? Ali G said that someone give a message over the radio to one of them fighter pilots, say, bomb Iraq, and the geezer don't hear it properly and bombs the wrong one? No danger, Mr. Baker replied. Well, apparently was a danger. Iran apparently was helping the 9/11 hijackers, and Iraq had nothing to do with it whatsoever. We bombed the wrong country because George mixed up an N and a Q? Could it be? Tongue-in-cheek. What's real and, you know, tragic and unfortunate is that we are bogged down in a war that we had no plan to win, no exit strategy for. Nearly 1,000 of our young men and women are dead, more than 1,000 coalition forces, and no end in sight. It's a true tragedy. Time for regime change in America on November 2nd. This is the Tom Hartman Program, talk radio for the rest of us.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
The Founding Fathers thought they'd stop corporations from ever overthrowing elected government. Little did they know that 200 years later, democracy would be stolen and twisted in the name of so-called conservative values. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. The Founders of America fought the Revolutionary War against the excessive corporate power of the East India Company, and presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower warned us that extremely big businesses could destroy democracy. You'll find this extraordinary American story in my book, Unequal Protection: The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with the rampant corruption of the Bush administration. It tells the dramatic story of how corporations hijacked the Bill of Rights, setting the stage for the CEO takeover of America. And it shows how we can take America back and tells the stories of Americans from Pennsylvania to California who are doing just that right now.
Unequal Protection is available in bookstores nationwide. And you can read several chapters online at unequalprotection.com. That's Unequal Protection.
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan, in his semi-annual testimony before the Senate Banking Committee, Greenspan said, "We are creating a problem that has to be addressed." He created a stir when he agreed with Democratic campaign statements that there is a growing gap in wages based on skill level. Greenspan said that upper-level income households have benefited more from the economic recovery than anyone else. He said the effect of increasing concentration of incomes is not desirable in a democratic society. While the Democrats blame President Bush's tax cuts for the disparity, Greenspan blames education.
Pilots' salaries at Delta Airlines took a major nosedive on Tuesday after the union was forced to increase its proposed wage cut from 13.5% to 23%. And Delta says that still may not be enough to avoid filing bankruptcy. The airline posted its worst financial record in 25 years and wants pilots to take a 30% cut in wages and, quote, increase their productivity.
On Monday, the U.S. Justice Department gave $500,000 to a Mexican and U.S. coalition for use in fighting the importation of underage sex slaves in Southern California. The Bilateral Safety Corridor Coalition is made up of more than 70 member organizations in both San Diego County and Tijuana, Mexico. The coalition says that young women and boys are lured from Latin America and Eastern European countries to Mexico. They are then trained and sold. Many times they are sent to work in hidden brothels on farms throughout San Diego County where they are forced to service the workers.
Was Dick Cheney doing business with terrorists? Federal prosecutors will put that question to a grand jury this week as they subpoena documents from oil services giant Halliburton regarding its Iranian operations from 1995 through 2000. Cheney was the chief executive at Halliburton during those years while Iran was under sanctions for supposed ties to terrorist activity. Halliburton is facing at least 5 separate investigations for illegal corporate conduct, including bribery in Nigeria, also while Cheney was chief executive.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. According to the Non-Governmental Bureau of National Affairs, unions won 58% of the 1,348 government-monitored workplace elections in 2003, the highest success rate for unions since BNA began watching them some 2 decades ago. Fewer union elections overall were held in 2003 compared to the year before, meaning that while the success rate is growing, the actual number of electoral victories are declining. This corresponds well to shrinking union membership rates in the overall workforce.
You've been listening to WIND, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Think you're not involved in your community? Think again. Spending your money with local businesses is more than an economic choice. It's a way you can have a say in the look and feel of your hometown. By creating a demand for local goods and services, we can ensure a place for the independent businesses that help give our communities character and keep them unique. The American Independent Business Alliance encourages you to get involved. Support your homegrown businesses. Find AMIBA online at amiba.net.
Walmart, we're told, is the epitome of free enterprise in America. Work hard, be innovative, achieve efficiencies, and your company will be rewarded with riches. Oh yes, one more thing, be sure to load up on government subsidies along the way. Good Jobs First, a research center that studies the doling out of public money to corporations, reports that the sprawling of Walmart's empire has been fueled by the steady injection of more than $1 billion from the pockets of us taxpayers, including taxes paid by local businesses that subsequently have been squeezed out of existence by Walmart's subsidized muscle. Digging into scattered, often hidden records of state and local governments, the center found 244 cases of giveaways, including construction grants, special tax breaks, and job training money. The average payout to a Walmart store was $2.8 million. Imagine being an independent pharmacy, hardware store, grocery, or other shop and having to compete with a multi-billion dollar giant that is then handed an extra $2.8 million tax-paid advantage over you. The actual subsidy is much larger, for the center was able to look at only a portion of the 2,900 Walmart stores. Also, the report covers only the direct development subsidies, not counting the huge wage subsidy it gets. Walmart pays at a poverty level and provides no health coverage for a majority of its workers, instead counting on food stamps, emergency rooms, and other publicly financed services to underwrite its workforce. Oh, tut tut, sniffed a Walmart PR flack. Don't you know that in 10 years the company has collected more than $52 billion in sales taxes that help finance local governments? Well, tut tut right back. That's not Walmart's money. So excuse us if we don't roll over in gratitude. This is Jim Hightower saying, to learn more and to help push for economic development policies that work for local folks, call Good Jobs First, 202-626-3780. I'm Jim Hightower, and I've approved this message.
Jim Hightower is not running for office, but he is back this campaign season with an important word about the regime of King George V.
Let's stop beating around the bush. These people are nuts.
Let's Stop Beating Around the Bush is Hightower's hilarious new best-selling book, offering you unvarnished facts, insight, and humor to get you through this year's political spin cycle. Buy Let's Stop Beating Around the Bush today and make politics fun again. Available at bookstores everywhere and on the web at jimhightower.com. Buy it today.
You need to buy or sell your home, but where do you start?
Sorry to interrupt, but the place to start is LendingTree.com. You can search home listings, have real estate agents compete for your business, and bankers compete for your mortgage. You can even get up to a $2,000 gift card to the Home Depot when you close with an agent certified by LendingTree. Call 1-800-555-TREE. That's 1-800-555-TREE, or visit LendingTree.com. Equal housing opportunity. Some restrictions may apply. See website for details and licensing. LendingTree, Inc. is not affiliated with the Home Depot.
He's the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. It's the second hour of our Thursday program, the time when we traditionally delve a little deeper into the things that we thought we knew, but we didn't know, but maybe you know, maybe you don't know, maybe you didn't even know that you needed to know, maybe even everything that you know is wrong.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could be. Maybe, maybe not. What do you know about Guantanamo? And what should the world know? Michael Ratner is the author of a new book called Guantanamo, What the World Should Know. Michael Ratner and Ellen Ray. And along with Anthony Lewis, who wrote a chapter for it called A President Beyond the Law, Michael Ratner is the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights and serves as the co-counsel in Rasul. Is that pronouncing it correctly?
That's correct. Rasul is the Supreme Court case charged in the Guantanamo detention.
There you go. Rasul v. Bush, the historic case of the Guantanamo detainees before the U.S. Supreme Court that you just won, right?
Right. It was a really big victory. I mean, not just big in terms of the clients, but really for the rule of law, and that the government—you have no government or prison that's beyond court review in some capacity.
Right.
They went back to the Magna Carta, 1215, to say this was affirmed 900 years ago, and we aren't letting this escape from us now.
That's remarkable. The Magna Carta. I mean, you know, and the Magna Carta didn't actually give rights to people like you and me. It just gave rights to the feudal lords.
Right, but it did have this clause in that I look at with my son when he was studying it. It's called Article 39 that says, really, and it really refers more to the lords or freemen, conceivably, that no person is to be imprisoned without a trial of some sort. And that's really essentially what this court went back to.
Yeah.
And in some ways, it shows how far off, how far outside of the legal system this current administration was and how it was treating Guantanamo people as well as others.
Yeah, I noticed in your book you have the original contract or treaty, I guess, that we signed with Cuba in 1901, that in which, of course, this was after the Spanish-American War, when we grabbed Cuba, the Puerto Rico, and the Philippines, in which they gave us Guantanamo Bay in order to defend Cuba.
They gave us, is a nice way to say it. What we did was we essentially intervened in the war on behalf of the Cubans, then when we got rid of the Spanish, took over Cuba and insisted as part of their constitution on 45 square miles of their territory, including the harbor at Guantanamo, and it can never be terminated unless the United States agrees to its termination.
Right.
And that's the way we got it. Our big argument, there were two arguments really in the Supreme Court, the U.S. decided the administration, that they were going to put people into this prison in Guantanamo because they figured, well, the U.S. courts don't really run there, the Cuban courts don't run there, and therefore we essentially have people out on the moon.
It's like outer space.
Arguments were two. Yeah. One is that Guantanamo is essentially U.S. territory. Yeah. Cubans have nothing to say about it. The U.S. is complete jurisdiction and control. They run the whole place. And that you can't, in that situation, the court should go there. And the second thing is that anybody detained anywhere in the world by the United States, except perhaps on the battlefield, anyone should have a right to test their detention in court. And the court really wasn't 100% clear on that second part. Certainly gave us the right in Guantanamo, and I think arguably, more than arguably, gave us the right on the broader issue that the U.S. can't act outside the law.
Yeah, and even on the battlefield, ultimately, you have to, you know, once hostilities cease, you have to provide people with access to some sort of process.
Well, that's correct. We're not saying that the commander who captures 10 troops on the other side has to, you know, that those guys can file a habeas corpus, you know, tomorrow, although technically they could, and if they did, the Supreme Court would just say, well, that he was taken properly. But we're really saying that as soon as you take those people outside of it, they have a right to test the legality of their detention.
Right.
It's such an incredibly wonderful affirmation of law and such a real setback and blow to this administration's view that it could, in the war on terror, treat people however they wanted, including, as I'm sure a number of your listeners know, including the use of torture.
Yeah. Interestingly, the Spanish-American War, along with the War of 1812, the Revolutionary War, World War I, and World War II, is one of only five wars that have actually been declared by Congress in the history of the United States. Here we have
that's right.
Here we have George W. attacking Iraq without a declaration of war by Congress. There was an authorization to use force, but it's a different thing. And he's calling.
Right. I would like to see declarations in these kind of cases, although the courts have essentially colluded with the Congress and the government and the executive to say that if you get a authorization to use force, that's sufficient. Although there are still many people who would argue that you need declarations to, you know, to trigger certain kinds of powers by the president.
Yeah.
And that without such formal declarations, the president doesn't have even the limited power that the Supreme Court has now given him, or the more limited power. But you know, that argument has so far fallen on pretty deaf ears.
Yeah, well, the Constitution is quite clear that only Congress has the power to authorize war, and James Madison wrote at length about, you know, how, you know, war is the father of all evils, and it'll corrupt the executive branch, and it'll turn a president into a king, and all these kinds of things, and that's why that war making power has to be held with Congress rather than with the executive. And
you see how outrageous it was here what they did with this authorization of force. They first, if you read the memos they put out, you know, they say that to protect the United States under this authorization, the president is not bound by laws that prohibit torture. I mean, that's been unheard of, really. I mean, that's what I call the Pinochet defense. Pinochet, yeah. The dictator of Chile, yeah. Who said, in the interest of national security, I can torture people.
Right. Now, these were just internal documents, though.
War power.
But these were just internal documents within the Bush administration. This wasn't something Congress signed off on. I think it's
weird. That's correct.
I think it's weird enough that what Congress signed off on was that George Bush, and I'm amazed that most Americans don't know this, that the congressional authorization that Kerry and Edwards voted for, that everybody says, oh, they voted for this thing, says that if the president of the United States is going to commence hostilities, he has to inform Congress in writing that the nation that he's commencing hostilities against, specifically Iraq, actually does present an immediate threat to the United States, and that we cannot wait any longer, and that all remedies have been exhausted. And George W. actually wrote a letter to Congress saying that. And it wasn't true at the time. It's not true now. We know in retrospect it wasn't true. We also know that he knew at the time that it wasn't true. You know, Hans Blix was out there going, hey, wait a minute, you know, this doesn't... Anyhow, we're ranting here. We're talking
about
Michael.
You know what I'm interested in? That point is a really important point you're making, because even the New York Times and other magazines and other newspapers say that, well, he really thought there were weapons of mass destruction there, and therefore he made a mistake and got bad intelligence. And they don't say what you just said, that he knew at the time that they were not an immediate threat. I, back then, and anybody who understood the nature of this administration and sometimes the nature of our country, understood that this was not that this was just an excuse to get a hold of Iraq and change the way the course in their view of the Middle East politics.
And the Middle East oil.
And in some sense, the president is still getting away with that excuse. But why is it that most people, Blix and everybody, a lot of other people, or most knowledgeable people, felt that that was a, that we knew back then that it was a lie.
Yeah. Well, and not only is he getting away with that excuse, but now today with the 9/11 Commission coming out, and in the previous hour I'd mentioned that there was a second part. That's actually the congressional investigation is going to have the second part. But the 9/11 Commission has now come out with this report, basically, that is the administration is loving this. Hey, it's all the CIA's fault.
You know, of course they are.
It's got nothing to do with George W. lying to us. Right.
I even wrote a book back then with other people at the center that before the war that said there's no evidence here of weapons of mass destruction. This is an excuse for this administration. All you had to do was go back 10 years before and see the documents that Rumsfeld, Feith, Powell even involved in, had written about use of U.S. military force in a more aggressive, muscular way.
Right.
And that's what they were doing here, and oil and all that stuff. And so if you knew that analysis, how could you believe what they were saying?
Right. It's the Project for a New American Century. And it's the letters and things are still on their website. We're talking with Michael Ratner, who is the author of Guantanamo, What the World Should Know, a new book published by Chelsea Green. Michael Ratner, what should the world know about Guantanamo?
Well, the world should know that this is really an offshore prison camp, the equivalent of Devil's Island, that people are treated as if they're animals in that place, that they were there 2.5 years. I have clients who have been released a few months ago, two from England, for example, two young men, 20, 22 years old, 20 when they were picked up as a result of bribes, never given any hearing, denied they had ever met Osama bin Laden. They're then shown a videotape. And the U.S. government says, that's you in there, the interrogators say. After 3 months of heavy interrogation, isolation, dogs, stripping, the whole bit, then they say, oh, yeah, that is us in the videotape. They then get interrogated 200 times, worse and worse conditions. Finally, because of a stink made in Britain, British intelligence proves, as they had originally said, that they were in London at the time or in England at the time, and they were released. So what we have in Guantanamo is a situation outside the law in which people are being treated inhumanely, really inhumanely, and in which is making our world more dangerous. That's what I want to stress. Two things here. It's making it more dangerous, first for Americans and American soldiers who are picked up and will then be treated as we are treating people in Guantanamo. And secondly, it's become iconic in the world for everything, and particularly the Muslim world, for everything the U.S. is doing wrong with Muslims.
Would it be a serious
issue, and that camp ought to be closed, much like Abu Ghraib has to be closed.
Yeah, would it be and apparently there's as many as 100 others around the world. The Red Cross is talking about there's a whole bunch of missing prisoners, but that's a whole other topic.
It's not really. You know, what we have here is a situation where the Red Cross was quite critical of Guantanamo. And now the Red Cross has come out with statements about what you're calling ghost detainees.
Right.
Ghost detainees are people who are essentially disappeared. Disappearance is an international law crime. It's what Pinochet did. Then you're talking about people who are just hidden from the Red Cross, even in Guantanamo. So we have a country right now and an administration that certainly until the Supreme Court ruling and even now afterwards is on a lawless, lawless path that is scary. It's medieval out there in terms of what they're doing to the rule of law in this world.
Michael Ratner, the author of Guantanamo, What the World Should Know, a new book. Michael, would it be appropriate or inappropriate to call Guantanamo a concentration camp?
Well, concentration camps, it's appropriate to the extent you're not talking about death camps. Obviously, death
right.
camps are very different.
There was a big difference between Dachau and Auschwitz. Auschwitz, it was an organized death camp. Dachau was a labor camp.
Right.
You know, I've been to
this
both.
This is really
of them.
It's a concentration camp and an interrogation camp.
Yeah.
It's an illegal interrogation camp. The Second World War, the Nazis, the Germans did use illegal interrogation camps. It was contrary to the Geneva Conventions. That's what we have set up here, an interrogation camp or a concentration camp in which we've taken people, not just interestingly from Afghanistan and Pakistan, the war zone or Afghanistan particularly, but we now feel that the president now believes that he has the authority to pick up people anywhere in the world and take them to Guantanamo and give them no process whatsoever. Luckily, the Supreme Court said and even saw that as outside the pale. That can't be done.
Right.
That was his assertion,
yeah.
That you could do that to anyone in the world.
We've got about 20 seconds left, Michael. When are they going to actually start releasing these people or processing them?
Once we won in the Supreme Court, and even before, once they took review, they started releasing a few people to try and make the court not rule against them. Now I hope that within the next 2 months we get a couple of hundred releases, and we get attorneys down there right away.
And then we find out what's going on.
So far, my view is they're out of compliance with the Supreme Court so far, but hopefully we'll change that.
Great. Michael Ratner, the author of Guantanamo, What the World Should Know. Michael, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
It's the Tom Hartman Program, 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
I'm sorry, there's nothing more we can do. No one wants to hear those devastating words from a doctor. But that's what millions of Americans suffering from diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and diabetes will be told if you vote for Ralph Nader. Americans who voted for Nader put Bush in the White House in 2000. As president, George W. put the brakes on embryonic stem cell research, which could lead to revolutionary new treatments and cures. John Kerry vows to push this research forward. George W. Bush is still taking orders from the religious right. He wants to stifle stem cell research. This time, don't help him. Don't vote for Ralph. The Committee for the Advancement of Stem Cell Research approved this message. It was not approved by any candidate, nor any candidate's committee. Visit CASCR.org.
At last, there's a positive focus on a condition that affects millions. Read The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. John Rady, author of User's Guide to the Brain, says this about The Edison Gene.
Once again, with tireless scholarship and a bit of poetry, Tom Hartman helps take us to the edge of knowing ourselves, our brains, and our world.
The Edison Gene, available in bookstores everywhere.
Hey, what does this word make you think of? Tchaikovsky.
Isn't it? So what's the word?
No, that is the word.
You lost me.
All right, who's Martha Graham?
She invented the graham cracker. Before her, there was only soda crackers.
Maybe they're not getting enough art. Kids who participate in the arts do better in school and in life. To learn more, visit AmericansForTheArts.org. Because all kids should get to appreciate Tchaikovsky's music and Martha Graham's dance. Art. Ask for more. A public service message brought to you by Americans for the Arts and the Ad Council.
In the foreword to Tom Hartman's book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late, renowned author Joseph Chilton Pierce writes,
to discover brilliant, innovative, creative, and original thinking is one of life's rare privileges. To discover that such a thinker has focused on the most critical of all issues facing our species is encouraging. Because The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight is a seminal work, offering a viewpoint original yet ancient, I see our situation today in a new light. And because of the scope and depth of this work, I find it inspiring as well as disturbing. I rather exhausted superlative in praise of Tom Hartman's book, The Prophet's Way, which I rightly called the most important book I've ever read. But now I find this sequel calling for equal praise, since the issue here addresses the whole of our species, and indeed all species.
The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late by Tom Hartman, in bookstores everywhere.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Pitch for last picks became suspect and bending low as if to hear.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Got an interesting letter from a fellow by the name of Joe in New York City. Speaking of the Republican National Convention that's going to be coming up. And I just have to share this with you intact because it's now I remember. It's funny what you know what you remember that you forgot, right? And I remember when this happened, and I wasn't watching it, but I remember the reporting on it. And Rudy Giuliani, of course, is going to be one of the family values guys who's going to be a featured speaker at the Republican convention coming up. Joe writes, Tom, I doubt if most of the country saw it, but I was living in New York City when Rudy was running for the Senate. The most amazing thing happened. His wife was the star in the Vagina Monologues, you know, the Broadway play. Sorry for the spelling. She gave a press conference for Midtown. It was covered live on New York One. New York One is literally Channel One in New York. It's like the local news cable channel. I've actually been on it. She wasn't going to go into the show because Rudy needed her help with the campaign, and the title of the show was giving him bad publicity. And he had been diagnosed with prostate cancer, and she wanted to be there to take care of the family and help him in his recovery. The press conference, this is his wife's press conference, in which she's saying that she's not going to do this Broadway show because the name of it, the Vagina Monologues, is like not going over well with the Republicans, and Rudy's running for the Senate as a Republican. Anyhow, the press conference was still on when Rudy started his own press conference downtown from City Hall. New York One went to a split screen with Rudy reading a prepared statement, and in a small box you could watch Donna Hanover Giuliani's reaction while she watched her husband's press conference. Her prepared statement read that after long discussion, his prepared statement read that after long discussions with his wife and advisors, he was filing for divorce. You could see the reaction in his wife's face. He had never even told her he was going to do this. The bum never even called. She was surrounded by reporters. She had just made a statement that for the length of his campaign and his illness, she was giving up her acting career to stand by her man. And this is how she finds out that he's up and leaving. Joe goes on to say, I was never a Giuliani supporter. As to their relationship, I pretty much felt it wasn't any of our business. But you couldn't help but see the stories in the press about his girlfriends. But nobody watching that day could believe what they were seeing. The guy is a bum. If he dares to say anything about family values and personal responsibility, well, we should all remember how he executes his own personal responsibility towards his family. Sincerely, Joe. Interesting little bit of history there. The Labor Department, Elaine Chao, the wife of Republican Senator and multimillionaire Mitch McConnell from Kentucky. Elaine Chao has, to much fanfare, announced that instead of filling housing shortfalls, instead of taking care of the homeless by providing them with housing, the Department of Labor today, well, this was yesterday, launched a website for the homeless. Yes, if you are homeless, you can go on the internet and see your own homeless website. Lane Child says, this web page, apparently it's only a page, furthers the administration's commitment to helping the homeless, including homeless veterans. The Department of Labor is committed to pooling our resources and working together with Congress, our federal, state, and local partners to achieve the president's goal of ending chronic homelessness in 10 years. And the way that they're going to end it is by letting homeless people who don't have computers or internet connections get on the internet and go look at the web page for homeless people, that Elaine Chao and the Department of Labor have put up. So your Republican strangeness. I mean, you see, this is what the conservative worldview. I mean, they have to twist this thing like a pretzel for it to make sense. And every now and then, it just becomes so style over substance. Let's say 29 minutes past the hour. For
For more than 27 years, the Progressive magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. Author and broadcast personality Studs Terkel calls In These Times his bi-weekly tonic. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. 1-800-827-0270.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan, in his semi-annual testimony before the Senate Banking Committee, Greenspan said, "We are creating a problem that has to be addressed." He created a stir when he agreed with Democratic campaign statements that there is a growing gap in wages based on skill level. Greenspan said that upper-level income households have benefited more from the economic recovery than anyone else. He said the effect of increasing concentration of incomes is not desirable in a democratic society. While the Democrats blame President Bush's tax cuts for the disparity, Greenspan blames education.
Pilot salaries at Delta Airlines took a major nosedive on Tuesday after the union was forced to increase its proposed wage cut from 13.5% to 23%. And Delta says that still may not be enough to avoid filing bankruptcy. The airline posted its worst financial record in 25 years and wants pilots to take a 30% cut in wages and, quote, increase their productivity.
On Monday, the U.S. Justice Department gave $500,000 to a Mexican and U.S. coalition for use in fighting the importation of underage sex slaves in Southern California. The Bilateral Safety Corridor Coalition is made up of more than 70 member organizations in both San Diego County and Tijuana, Mexico. The coalition says that young women and boys are lured from Latin America and Eastern European countries to Mexico. They are then trained and sold. Many times they are sent to work in hidden brothels on farms throughout San Diego County where they are forced to service the workers.
Was Dick Cheney doing business with terrorists? Federal prosecutors will put that question to a grand jury this week as they subpoena documents from oil services giant Halliburton regarding its Iranian operations from 1995 through 2000. Cheney was the chief executive at Halliburton during those years while Iran was under sanctions for supposed ties to terrorist activity. Halliburton is facing at least 5 separate investigations for illegal corporate conduct, including bribery in Nigeria, also while Cheney was chief executive.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. According to the Non-Governmental Bureau of National Affairs, unions won 58% of the 1,348 government-monitored workplace elections in 2003, the highest success rate for unions since BNA began watching them some 2 decades ago. Fewer union elections overall were held in 2003 compared to the year before, meaning that while the success rate is growing, the actual number of electoral victories are declining. This corresponds well to shrinking union membership rates in the overall workforce.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. They're running out of bullets. Yeah, running out of bullets. Yeah, we should take up a national collection. We could get people in every city in America to set up, you know, at their home or their place of business, or we could put up little collection boxes on the corners. We could do it like the Red Cross does, you know, with little red kettles out in front of places of business. Bring your bullets here. I mean, it's shades of World War II. I mean, when women were told not to wear nylons because they needed the nylon to make parachutes and And metal was rationed, gasoline was rationed. Metal was rationed to make tanks and bullets. Lead was rationed, car batteries, hard to come by, because they needed the lead for bullets. Well, the Washington Post reports this morning that the U.S. military, says the Center for American Progress, the U.S. military is running short on one crucial wartime need, bullets. The Pentagon underestimated both production need and the level of resistance soldiers would face in Iraq. Until U.S. production can be brought up to speed, the Army is taking unusual stopgap measures, says the Washington Post, such as buying ammunition from England and Israel. I really think that we should be, that they should be taking up a collection. Probably George W. won't do that, you know. It's but boy, wouldn't that bring the country together? Wouldn't it be just a marvelous kind of, let's all pitch in, folks. The military is out of bullets because George W. didn't have any kind of plan for Iraq. They had this fantasy that they would be able to, you know, everybody knew that they could knock over Saddam, right? Here's this guy who's, you know, sanctions for 8 years. One of the highest child mortality rates, infant mortality rates in the world, because we were refusing to sell them chlorine to process their water because it could also be made into chlorine gas, you know, into poison gas. The sanctions were really, really hurting the Iraqi people. And we had bombed their air force out of existence. They literally had none. They had virtually nothing. Nobody thought that it was going to be particularly difficult to knock this guy over. But the fantasy that you can go into a country, overthrow its government, occupy the country, and all the people are going to, and, you know, former expatriates like Ahmed Chalabi, who've been outside the country for 30 years and you know, gotten rich and they're toadies to your country and all that, bring them in and set them up and set up a phone. And the people are just going to go, oh, isn't this wonderful? It just, you know, it doesn't happen. There's no precedent. It doesn't happen. I'm sorry. For a country that is not, I mean, you know, maybe if Iraq was in the middle of actually attacking somebody, the people of Iraq would say, okay, you beat us fair and square, you know, we feel chastised like Germany and Japan did after the war. We shouldn't have done that. We realize there's a penalty to pay, a price to pay. You know, we'll go along with this. But they're just, you know, sitting around. You know, Saddam's doing his wacky dictator routine, but the people of Iraq are sitting around trying to, you know, mind their own business, trying to make their lives work. And we come in and say, okay, we're in charge now. By the way, half of you are now unemployed. And we're changing your constitution. We're going to make it so that Americans can come in and buy all of your companies and don't have to leave any profits here in the country and don't have to hire Iraqis. They can hire Filipinos to do those things. They'll work cheaper than the Iraqis. So you're unemployed and we're buying your country. That part of it that we haven't already taken. And, by the way, we would like some oil. We would definitely like some oil. In fact, on the way in, George W. said,
your fate will depend on your actions. Do not destroy oil wells.
Right. Don't destroy those oil wells. That's ours. We're on the way. We're going to take those. And the people will just go, oh, isn't this wonderful? Yes. Here, have our oil. No, I don't think so. I don't think so. And so now the United States Army is out of bullets. We had the same problem with body armor. You know, we had enough, apparently, for the guys who went charging in. But for the first 15 months of the occupation, there wasn't enough body armor. Military families taking up collections. Police departments in the United States who had body armor were loaning it to soldiers in Iraq. Many of them Many of them were actually over there. Just down the street from us here in Vermont, there's a family with a yellow ribbon out on the tree in front of their house. The guy's a state policeman. And he's in the reserves. And guess what? He's in Iraq. So, you know, if he had some body armor, I don't know if he did or not, but presumably the state police are fairly well funded. He probably took it with him. I know a lot of them have. And last September, the Army's vice chief of staff admitted that the military miscalculated the number of armored Humvees they were going to need, leaving many soldiers unprotected, and now leaving many soldiers, over 900 of them, dead. It's really pretty mind-boggling when you think about it, you know? 900 human beings. 900 families, 900 lives. And over 6,000 missing arms, legs, eyes. And it's going to be tens of thousands coming back with post-traumatic stress disorder and other serious, less visible wounds. So I think we should take up a collection. I think it's just, you know, it's a great time. We should be taking up a collection. Time to do it. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. It's interesting, writes Kevin in Ohio, that you were talking about the moon landing yesterday. Apparently somebody at NASA is listening to this program. Because somebody called in and says, you know, there are no pictures of Buzz Aldrin on the moon. You know, going along with this conversation that Rama Schneider and I started on Tuesday, which was the anniversary of the moonwalk, where I was saying, okay, I remember seeing that picture of, you know, the first guy on the moon walking down the ladder, and who took the picture? And there's a lot of speculation. So the second guy on the moon was Buzz Aldrin. And somebody called and said, there's no pictures of Buzz. And so yesterday afternoon, apparently, according to this, writer here, apparently just after our program, NASA just released new pictures from the moon. And guess who's on the front page? This is at www.apolloarchive.com/apollo_gallery.html. Buzz Aldrin. So there are pictures of Buzz Aldrin on the moon. In the general email department, a fellow by the name of Peter. Dear Tom, I'm a German expat living and working in the Middle East, Doha, Qatar. I just wanted to congratulate you on your show. It's great to hear that you're addressing the root problems of your country, mainly your president, who claims to have liberated Iraq and that the world has become a better place. Maybe Mr. Bush and his colleagues are in a different movie. I hope for America that the voters come to their senses and send GWB back to Texas, or better yet, get him to join Mr. Milosevic in The Hague at the War Tribunal. Thanks for the great show. Thank you, Peter, for the kind email. Linda Ronstadt, I got into this a little bit at the very end of the third hour of yesterday's program, and it really stirred some folks up, and I just want to just nail this thing down. Linda Ronstadt, yesterday in Los Angeles, started out her gig by saying, "Seen any good movies lately?" And the audience just loved it. They went nuts. They all started applauding and cheering. And this is a story in one of the entertainment papers, AnPop.com. This time, they say, her audience knew what to expect. And that was my point yesterday, was that if you know what you're going to, if you're expecting that somebody's going to be political and they're political and you're paying for entertainment, cool, that's part of the entertainment. But if you're not expecting to, you know, if I went to hear somebody who was just, you know, I thought they were going to be singing songs, and they were not, and it wasn't Bob Dylan or Rage Against the Machine or now Linda Ronstadt, and they had never been out about their politics, and they started talking about how George Bush is a wonderful guy or the Holocaust never happened or something, I'd be offended. But in the case of Linda Ronstadt, I may well have been wrong, because the real story, apparently, is that this whole thing has been twisted by the right wing. Robert Earle, one of the guys, this according to BBC, one of the men buying the Aladdin Casino where this so-called incident happened, said he was very sorry to hear that she'd been banned. He said, "We respect artists' creativity and support their rights to express themselves." There are 4,500 people in the crowd, and where she called Michael Moore a great American patriot. And what's interesting is that, and in fact, the New York Times even got into the act yesterday, saying that, you know, defending Linda Ronstadt's right to say whatever she wants to say. But here's the interesting thing. The Tucson Citizen runs this story by Daniel Buckley. He actually interviewed her. She was not booed off the stage by a concert crowd that erupted in mayhem, she said. In fact, it was an hour and a half after she left the stage that she learned that anybody was upset. And that was when, well, she says that she was leaving, actually. So it wasn't, you know, the owner who came up and threw her out. In fact, it says, after the concert, she went backstage and was about to head to the car provided for her by the Aladdin when she was confronted by an Aladdin employee. And now, quoting Linda Ronstadt, "This woman comes huffing up to me and says, 'I'm afraid I can't let you leave.' I said, 'What?' And she said, 'You can't leave because the owner's on his way over here to talk to you,' the singer said. She declined and left for the Ritz-Carlton in her tour bus, where the employee said the Aladdin car would not be allowed to leave. When the employee, "I thought she was going to read me my Miranda rights or make me start writing things on the blackboard," says Linda Ronstadt. "I didn't know they were mad at me until we were gone. And I didn't know what they were mad at me about until an hour later, when apparently they called up one of the people that was traveling with us and went, 'She's talking about Michael Moore, and this is a place for entertainment, not politics.'" Apparently, Linda Ronstadt has been saying this at every concert she's been doing. So, I stand corrected. She's not one of those entertainers who has not been out about their politics. This is remarkable. What's amazing is how the Los Angeles Times and the AP went with the right-wing spin that she was not allowed to return to her room when actually she was staying at the Ritz-Carlton, that she was booed off stage when she wasn't, that people were throwing drinks at her, never happened. Fascinating, huh? Fascinating. 13 minutes before the hour, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Ann in Sarasota, Florida is on the line. Hey, Ann, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I don't know if you get to hear the breaks, the news breaks that they have on the show, but I was listening in, and they had comments about Greenspan in a meeting today when they were discussing that the so-called recovery has been great for the upper classes, those higher wage earners, but the lower and middle-class wage earners have been left behind in this so-called recovery.
Greenspan said that?
Well, they were talking about it, and the Democrats are saying it's because of Bush's tax cuts that he did for the rich. It didn't help out the lower-income people like it helped the rich.
Right.
Greenspan was blaming it on education. He's saying these people just need to be better educated so they can get better jobs, and then they would recover also.
Right. Not only
and
that.
I think that is hilarious considering the trade policies and the tax policies of this administration.
Yeah, not only that, in today's Wall Street Journal, there's a piece that I clipped out. I was going to talk about it today, in fact, and probably will in the next hour. That Greenspan actually yesterday was basically saying, he said George Bush's tax cuts are a good thing, but it's not a good thing that we have these huge deficits, and therefore we need to look at structural adjustments. And then he mentioned Social Security and Medicare. You have to keep in mind that Greenspan is an old-school objectivist libertarian who truly believes that Social Security, Medicare, unemployment payments, any kind of workman's compensation, minimum wage laws, child labor laws are all forms of socialism and inappropriate interference in the marketplace by government.
Amazing.
And I mean, he just totally believes this, and there's a lot of people who believe this. I mean, this is the core of the conservative philosophy. They don't talk about it out loud very much, but this is where they're at, and that's Mr. Greenspan. Absolutely.
Well, I have a friend that is, has an engineering degree, and she does drafting and things for manufacturing type jobs. She's been unemployed for almost 2 years now. She cannot get a job using her degree because all the manufacturing is being shipped elsewhere out of the country.
Sure.
She's got a Bachelor of Science degree. How much more education does she need to be a part of this recovery?
Yeah, the bottom line is Greenspan and the cons on this thing are just absolutely full of it. I mean, it's toad poop, to use the famous phrase. It's nonsense. It's total, absolute nonsense. But the conservatives are going to continue chanting that mantra. Ann, thanks for the call. We got to move along
here.
Have a great afternoon. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 10 minutes before the hour. Helping you win the water cooler wars.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242-8272.
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul out of his Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive Magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555 and mention the...
Maybe craft into the birthing of something truly new. And you can play your part in shaping this new worldview by joining Tom Hartman September 10th through 12th. To find out how, go to the website greatmystery.org. That's greatmystery.org. Together, we will make a difference.
A state trooper with a good eye stops zebra mussels at a weigh station. I'm Richard Hoops for Earthwatch Radio. Zebra mussels invaded the Great Lakes as stowaways in the ballast water of ocean-going ships. They might invade the Pacific Northwest by way of recreational boats and interstate highways. In May, an officer of the Washington State Patrol found live zebra mussels on the side of a boat from Tennessee. It was being hauled through a port of entry on Interstate 90. The discovery illustrates the need for boaters everywhere to take responsibility for cleaning their watercraft. Pam Meacham is an invasive species expert with Washington's Department of Fish and Wildlife. She says zebra mussels are a huge ecological and economic problem. They're prolific, and they can change aquatic ecosystems and clog water intake pipes. Meacham says state troopers in Washington are trained to look for zebra mussels on boats at weigh stations, but that only works for boats that are hauled by large trucks that have to stop for inspection. Meacham says smaller trucks don't have to stop.
Vehicles that are less than 26,000 pounds do not have to stop at the scales for the state patrol. There are a lot of people out there with large pickup trucks that are able to haul 30 to 35 foot boats, so there are a number of boats coming through that could be coming in from infested areas with zebra mussels that we're not catching.
Zebra mussels can live out of water for days and can survive a long trip on a boat or trailer. Meacham says that means boaters have to take action to keep them from spreading.
If you wish to have fishable and swimmable waters, then you need to take some responsibility for seeing to it that you do not spread invasive species that will damage your waters.
Meacham says boaters need to be sure their watercraft are cleaned thoroughly before they hit the road. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Sea Grant Program and the Gaylord Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin.
103 days? No. It's the Tom Hartman Program brought to you today by the Committee for the Advancement of Stem Cell Research, www.cascr.org. Benjamin Krim, 1-888-242-8272 for a free audio tape. And Small Dog Electronics, you can reach them at 1-800-511-MAX, 511-MACS. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, and Chris in Milwaukee, Wisconsin is on the line. Hey, Chris, what's on your mind?
I just wanted to pass along, and you can maybe verify this, but I'm pretty sure I heard the NPR News also report the boot off stage version for Linda Ronstadt.
Everybody was reporting.
Yeah, they may have said, you know, it was reported in such and such, but they were sure passing it along.
Yeah.
And, you know, sure enough, there was a guy on Fox News this morning saying, you know, that wasn't true. That,
Interesting. You mean Fox News actually corrected a story?
No,
that was...
they had a guest on who kind of went through, here's what happened. And so they, you know, I think they're kind of running out of people, you know, to just sit there and back up their
shills. You mean,
you know, they get these people on now, and they kind of think they're going one place, and they're not. And
or maybe they're getting enough heat. I mean, you know, all across the country on Sunday, people were having outfoxed parties,
right?
Where they were inviting total strangers into their homes to watch this movie. It's the number one selling DVD on Amazon.com.
That'd be nice if they're starting to pull back to the left. But I just wanted to, let you know that I'm positive I heard NPR went with that, too.
Yeah, remarkable. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
Yeah, and Fox is not going to pull back to the left. They're going to pull back. First of all, it wouldn't be back because, you know, when Roger Ailes started this thing, the former Republican operative on behalf of the conservative billionaire Rupert Murdoch, when they started this thing, and they lost hundreds of millions of dollars, I don't know the exact amount, but they were losing money right up until this year. I mean, they lost money for years and years, you know, from the day that they started until today, as far as I can tell. And so there's no back to, but, you know, maybe they would move to the middle. Maybe it's a result of the outfoxed pressure. Who knows? I doubt it. I'm very skeptical. I think that they're gonna kind of bully through. They're gonna make their way through this little bad patch of PR, and they're gonna continue being apologists for the Reich Wing in the United States, as does everybody else, you know, in this giant talk radio Reich Wing machine, and a fully owned subsidiary of the Republican Party. So, unless there's a change in November. It's Tom Hartman. Thanks.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
The Founding Fathers thought they'd stop corporations from ever overthrowing elected government. Little did they know that 200 years later, democracy would be stolen and twisted in the name of so-called conservative values. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. The founders of America fought the Revolutionary War against the excessive corporate power of the East India Company, and presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower warned us that extremely big businesses could destroy democracy. You'll find this extraordinary American story in my book, Unequal Protection: The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with the rampant corruption of the Bush administration. It tells the dramatic story of how corporations hijacked the Bill of Rights, setting the stage for the CEO takeover of America. And it shows how we can take America back and tells the stories of Americans from Pennsylvania to California who are doing just that right now.
Unequal Protection is available in bookstores nationwide. And you can read several chapters online at unequalprotection.com. That's Unequal Protection.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan, in his semi-annual testimony before the Senate Banking Committee, Greenspan said, "We are creating a problem that has to be addressed." He created a stir when he agreed with Democratic campaign statements that there is a growing gap in wages based on skill level. Greenspan said that upper-level income households have benefited more from the economic recovery than anyone else. He said the effect of increasing concentration of incomes is not desirable in a democratic society. While the Democrats blame President Bush's tax cuts for the disparity, Greenspan blames education.
Pilots' salaries at Delta Airlines took a major nosedive on Tuesday after the union was forced to increase its proposed wage cut from 13.5% to 23%. And Delta says that still may not be enough to avoid filing bankruptcy. The airline posted its worst financial record in 25 years and wants pilots to take a 30% cut in wages and, quote, increase their productivity.
On Monday, the U.S. Justice Department gave $500,000 to a Mexican and U.S. coalition for use in fighting the importation of underage sex slaves in Southern California. The Bilateral Safety Corridor Coalition is made up of more than 70 member organizations in both San Diego County and Tijuana, Mexico. The coalition says that young women and boys are lured from Latin America and Eastern European countries to Mexico. They are then trained and sold. Many times they are sent to work in hidden brothels on farms throughout San Diego County where they are forced to service the workers.
Was Dick Cheney doing business with terrorists? Federal prosecutors will put that question to a grand jury this week as they subpoena documents from oil services giant Halliburton regarding its Iranian operations from 1995 through 2000. Cheney was the chief executive at Halliburton during those years while Iran was under sanctions for supposed ties to terrorist activity. Halliburton is facing at least 5 separate investigations for illegal corporate conduct, including bribery in Nigeria, also while Cheney was chief executive.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. According to the Non-Governmental Bureau of National Affairs, unions won 58% of the 1,348 government-monitored workplace elections in 2003, the highest success rate for unions since BNA began watching them some 2 decades ago. Fewer union elections overall were held in 2003 compared to the year before, meaning that while the success rate is growing, the actual number of electoral victories are declining. This corresponds well to shrinking union membership rates in the overall workforce.
You've been listening to WIND, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Think you're not involved in your community? Think again. Spending your money with local businesses is more than an economic choice. It's a way you can have a say in the look and feel of your hometown. By creating a demand for local goods and services, we can ensure a place for the independent businesses that help give our communities character and keep them unique. The American Independent Business Alliance encourages you to get involved. Support your homegrown businesses. Find AMIBA online at amiba.net.
When conservatives bellow that they want to slash the number of federal employees, they usually don't have our ever-helpful park rangers in mind for the slashing. People love rangers, mainly because they're, well, helpful. Teaching us about the ancient cliff dwellers at Mesa Verde, guiding us along the Appalachian Trail, or bringing Lincoln's Gettysburg Address to life. Yet, while politicians of all stripes praise park rangers and give tribute to the majesty of our national parks, forests, seashores, monuments, and wilderness areas, they're deadbeats when it comes to paying the bill to keep these treasures in place and in good repair. Washington routinely shortchanges these assets, resulting today in an inadequate number of rangers to meet the public's need and a growing backlog of maintenance just to keep our parks from falling apart. George W., who campaigned as a Teddy Roosevelt-style park lover, promised that he would eliminate that backlog within 5 years. But instead, it's grown by as much as $3 billion since he's been in office. And while he claims to have boosted the budget of the Park Service, it's nowhere near enough to make up for the increased number of park visitors or the added burden of homeland security requirements that he put on the service. The operating budget is estimated to be $600 million a year short of what's needed. So our national treasures, which the overwhelming majority of Americans love, are crumbling. Unsafe trails, broken facilities, closed-off areas, shortages of guides and interpreters, shorter hours, and locked visitor centers. This is Jim Hightower saying, where'd the money go? To tax giveaways for the richest people in America, to Halliburton's fraud-ridden contracts in Iraq, to George's Star Wars fantasies, to his unlimited and unbudgeted warmongering, and to multi-billions of dollars in corporate welfare. Take just 10% of that money back, and our parks would again gleam like the gems they are.
I'm sorry, there's nothing more we can do. No one wants to hear those devastating words from a doctor. But that's what millions of Americans suffering from diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and diabetes will be told if you vote for Ralph Nader. Americans who voted for Nader put Bush in the White House in 2000. As president, George W. put the brakes on embryonic stem cell research, which could lead to revolutionary new treatments and cures. John Kerry vows to push this research forward. George W. Bush is still taking orders from the religious right. He wants to stifle stem cell research. This time, don't help him. Don't vote for Ralph. The Committee for the Advancement of Stem Cell Research approved this message. It was not approved by any candidate, nor any candidate's committee. Visit CASCR.org.
Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast, border to border, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number if you'd like to be on. At the end of the third hour yesterday, just as we were coming up on about a minute and a half left to go with the show, Jim in West Virginia called and wanted to take me to task, pointing out that, in his opinion, Saddam had kicked inspectors out of Iraq, which is a factual error, but I pointed that out. Anyhow, he called back a couple of times after we got off the air and left messages on our machine to the effect that I had cut him off. Jim, I want you to know, if you're listening, and any other conservatives, anybody, I mean, for that matter, please call back. I mean, we just ran out of time. I was talking over you because we ran out of time. I love it when people disagree with me. And I will absolutely put you on the air and give you your opportunity to speak. As long as it's not obscene, no problem. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. I've got an I Am a Conservative list here for you. Today we have, of course, the 9/11 Commission providing some cover, somewhat inadvertently, for the Bush administration to claim, it was all bad information, it's all the CIA's fault, and of course it was George Tenet who was appointed by Bill Clinton, so it must all be Bill Clinton's fault. And, you know, on it goes, right? On it goes. The great spin machine, 8 minutes after the hour. Let's take a call here. Scott in Santa Rosa, California on the line. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Oh, I was just wondering why the Kerry campaign isn't getting more mileage out of the Enron connection with Bush. For example, why doesn't he charge Bush directly by saying, I believe you had a connection. I believe that Ken Lay wrote your energy policy. Are you willing to deny it publicly?
My guess on this, good question, Scott, and I've wondered, yeah, I mean, that's like one of maybe 100 just really potent issues that the Kerry campaign could bring up. And my guess is, and I've wondered why they haven't been brought up before. I mean, Howard Dean, for example, was raising a lot of these things on the campaign. Well, actually, a lot of these guys were. Gephardt was talking about this stuff on the campaign trail as well. My guess is that the conventional wisdom, or what all the people in inside politics believe, is that 12 or 15 or 20% of Americans who are the swing voters who are going to actually decide the election really don't start paying attention to politics until October. And so through the month of October and in the context of presidential debates and in the last 5-6 weeks of the election, running up to the election, that's when you'll see Kerry coming out with this really some really tough stuff. You know, where are your service records from you know, and on it goes. I mean, the Clinton administration, not the Clinton, the Gore campaign, did this to George W. Bush. 1 week before the election, they rolled out the fact, which they had obviously been sitting on for some time, that George W. was a convicted criminal. You know, that he had been arrested and convicted of drunk driving. And so,
Well, I hope so, and I hope to see commercials with him in front of the Enron corporate jet, and I hope he also charges something that I think is going to happen, and that is that Ken Lay will be pardoned. And I think that I would ask publicly, if he's convicted, are you going to pardon Ken Lay, Kenny Boy, good old Kenny Boy, or are you going to let him go to prison?
Well, George won't care on the way out the door because he doesn't have a vice president who's going to run for president. He doesn't, and he's finished his political ambitions. Maybe his brother. I mean, you know, the idea is that George, if he wins this time for the first time, that his brother Jeb will run in 2008. But I have a feeling that the American public is sort of running out of it with the Bush family and their connection with the Bin Laden family and the Carlyle Group and all this. I think people are over it. But the thing that you can absolutely expect is in the last 6 weeks of this election, you know, basically October, last week or two of September through October up until November 2nd is going to be real interesting because the Republicans are going to be pulling Osama bin Laden out of the hat. The Iranian news service in February reported that they already had Osama bin Laden, that we had captured him. And we talked about it on this program. And it's, you know, widely, quote, known, right? It's one of the main rumors on the Arab street, you know, in the Middle East, that we've been sitting on Osama for months and, you know, waiting for the election to come. But who knows? I mean, it's like that we're going to see October surprises from both campaigns toward the end.
Well, I hope we see some good ones, and thank you for putting me on.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling, Scott. Good to hear from you. It's 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. I am a conservative, writes Mark Oberzill on jeffnewman.net and other places. I've seen this before. I am a conservative. I believe in staying solvent and out of debt. I'm a conservative. I believe in keeping my nose out of other people's business, their nations, and their bedrooms. I'm a conservative. I believe in conserving our assets and our resources, our land, our air, our water. Accordingly, I don't support or engage in wastefulness, inefficiency, or lavish excesses. I am a conservative. I think that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Therefore, I support appropriate government spending on such things as infrastructure, schools, social welfare, and crime prevention, because in the long run, it's cheaper and more effective. I'm a conservative. I don't sign on to risky schemes. Think of trickle-down economics. I think if you give Bob a dollar, it helps Bob, but it may not necessarily help Oscar, Fred, or Maria. I am a conservative. I'm attacked. I respond appropriately and conservatively. I do not swap mosquitoes with dynamite. I am a conservative. I don't deal falsely or prematurely with facts. I'm a conservative. I understand the purposes of various institutions. It's the job of the government to govern, the job of a religion to address spiritual needs, and the job of business to secure profits by producing needed goods and services. I do not confuse these institutions. I'm a conservative. I understand my position in the world and that my opinions are not the only valid ones. I do not have an exclusive claim on what is right, good, or patriotic, and those who disagree with me are not automatically evil traitors. What's really weird, though, is that I've always thought these things, but now everyone calls me a liberal. I find that fascinating. You know, speaking as someone who in 1964 went door to door at the age of 13 years old, knocking on people's doors, passing out campaign literature for Barry Goldwater. Yes, I did. In my heart, I knew he was right. I can tell you that there's really not that much difference between the old line, Goldwater, Eisenhower conservatives, who believe basically the things that I just read to you, and the people today who are called liberal, because the people who today are calling themselves conservatives are actually fascists. And you say, what? What fascists? He's talking about Hitler? No. Adolf Hitler ultimately was not a fascist. He was a dictator. Benito Mussolini invented the word fascism. I wrote a piece about this on commondreams.org. You go to commondreams.org or tomhartman.com and click on articles on democracy. You can read it. The vice president of the United States, Henry A. Wallace, under Roosevelt, 1944, wrote a piece about this for the New York Times. The word fascist, or fascism, means literally merging the interests of corporations and the state. That's all it means. And that's what's going on with the modern conservative agenda. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, Jonathan in Palm Desert, California, is on the line. Hey, Jonathan, what's up?
Hey there. Actually, right on that topic, speaking about fascism, I was going through the White Rose Society archives.
Yeah, right, whiterosesociety.org, yes.
Yep, that's episodes, including the one where he's pointing out the four key points of fascism, according to Orwell.
Mm-hmm.
Pointing out how Bush's speech is conformed to it.
Yeah.
And I came across this really weird little clip where George Bush is saying how horrible Saddam Hussein is, that he doesn't let little children fly kites, and how little girls get beaten for wearing white shoes, and that sort of thing. And I thought, wait a second. In Fahrenheit 9/11, of course, they've got that one little clip of the kids flying a kite.
Oh, is that weird? You wonder if Moore heard that.
Is that it's a major criticism of that movie from a lot of conservatives saying, oh, this is horrible, him showing little kids flying kites.
You know, I'll bet you, Jonathan, that what happened, Moore had to leave half that movie on the cutting room floor. You know, I mean,
yeah.
he put the thing together and he ended up with, you always do. I mean, the same thing when I write books. My new book, What Would Jefferson Do? The first draft that I submitted to the publisher was 100,000 words. They threw it back to me and they said, you know, cut it down to 70,000 words and then we'll publish
it. I'm an animator. I know that sort of stuff.
Yeah, okay, so you know. So I'll bet that in the original version of the movie, Moore had that clip of George W. Bush saying that, and then he played the video. Because otherwise, you know, the context isn't quite as strong. And that was one of those, you know, many things that ended up on the cutting room floor. That's my guess.
Yeah, I just find it fascinating that that's one of those things that the conservatives have been harping on about that movie as being such a horrible misrepresentation. And to hear that little Bush talking, it's one of those things that goes down the memory hole and people just forget about.
Yeah, yeah. That's an interesting one. I frankly haven't heard that, so I'll have to, you know, if you drop me an email with a pointer to it.
Yeah, just go to the whiterose.org society,
mm-hmm.
And I think it's like the first time.
He's great. He's a real talent and a real genius.
Looking forward to him coming back to Air America.
Yeah, I agree. 17, thanks a lot, Jonathan. 17 minutes after the hour, the Marriage Protection Act. We couldn't pass the day without mentioning this. This is scheduled for a vote today in the House of Representatives. In fact, they may have already voted on it. I don't believe so, though. I haven't seen anything come by on the wires. The Marriage Protection Act. Here's the bottom line on this thing. The Republicans. And I have to say, this isn't conservative liberal. I think this is really Republican Democrat, because this is going to be a straight party line vote. And there are conservative Democrats and there are a few moderate Republicans. The Marriage Protection Act basically says, for the first time in the 228-year history of the United States. Now, get this and get it right. For the first time in the history of the United States, we are going to tell a group of people that they do not have the right to take their grievances to a court. We have three branches of government in the United States, the executive, the legislative, and the judicial. We vote for the executive through the Electoral College. We vote for the electors. We vote for the legislative. And we have access to the judicial. But the Marriage Protection Act will say, sorry, if you're gay, you cannot use the courts. Everybody else can, but if you're gay, you can't. For the first time in the history of America, they are trying to pass a law. Well, I shouldn't say for the first time in the history of America. Actually, this was the situation that African Americans faced right up until the 1960s. And they're trying to bring it back. It's wrong. 20 after the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
I'm sorry. There's nothing more we can do. No one wants to hear those devastating words from a doctor. But that's what millions of Americans suffering from diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and diabetes will be told if you vote for Ralph Nader. Americans who voted for Nader put Bush in the White House in 2000. As president, George W. put the brakes on embryonic stem cell research, which could lead to revolutionary new treatments and cures. John Kerry vows to push this research forward. George W. Bush is still taking orders from the religious right. He wants to stifle stem cell research. This time, don't help him. Don't vote for Ralph. The Committee for the Advancement of Stem Cell Research approved this message. It was not approved by any candidate, nor any candidate's committee. Visit CASCR.org.
For more than 27 years, the Progressive magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. Author and broadcast personality Studs Terkel calls In These Times his bi-weekly tonic. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. 1-800-827-0270.
Do the Republicans or the Democrats have a clear vision for America that actually includes democracy, fairness, and justice? Do the Greens or the Progressives? How can we create a shared vision of the kind of future we want for our children? This is Tom Hartman, and I'll be exploring these and many other issues with guests from a wide variety of viewpoints, as well as taking your calls.
The Tom Hartman Show, 12 p.m. till 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul out of his Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555 and mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman Program. That's the Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Is there anybody here who'd like to wrap the flag around an early grave?
I don't think so.
Is there anybody here who thinks they're standing tall around a battle wave?
Welcome back.
Is there anybody here who'd like to do his part? Soldier to the world and a hero to his heart. I want to see him. I want to wish him luck. I want to shake his hand.
Sort of reminds you of that part in Fahrenheit 9/11 where Michael Moore is going up to members of Congress in Washington, D.C. with a with two recruiters from the Marine Corps saying, would you like to sign up one of your children to go to Iraq? And the just absolutely dumbfounded looks he gets from these people. That's amazing. Well, the poll results are in. It's the George Bush flip-flop of the year. Of this year. I mean, you know, one of many, of course. But his most recent flip-flop, the poll results, in February, the polls were showing that Americans wanted a tough president who could wage a war. So, for example, on Meet the Press on February 8th, George Bush said, "I'm a war president. I make decisions here in the Oval Office and foreign policy matters with war on my mind." And the San Francisco Chronicle noted, and I quote, "Bush's strategy," this was that week, the day after, "Bush's strategy in the interview, taped Saturday and broadcast Sunday, was underscored by his repeated emphasis on war, terrorism, and national security issues," he said, "have shaped his presidency and his leadership." He mentioned the word war no less than 24 times and said, "I'm a war president." Yeah, that was in February. 24 times. 24 times he mentions the word war in an interview in Meet the Press in February, when the word war was polling pretty well. Okay, the word war is no longer polling well. The focus groups are showing Karl Rove is running his focus groups and whatnot, and they're showing that people really are tired of war. There's too many coffins have come home, too many wounded people. Now we'd really have peace now. So last week, let's see, the 20th, actually day before yesterday, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, George Bush in his speech said, "You just got to know, nobody wants to be a war president. I want to be a peace president." And the Associated Press noted yesterday, Bush used the words peace or peaceful a total of 20 times in the speech. So the poll results are in, and we discover that we've gone from a war president to a peace president. Yes, that's absolutely woo. The battleground states, it's shaping up. Right, the battleground. And jobs are really going to be an issue. And here we have Michigan and Ohio. USA Today says yesterday there's weakness in employment in two states, Michigan and Ohio. The polls show could go either way in the presidential race. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, it's just if you look at West Virginia, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, Oregon, Arizona, Missouri, every one of these states, well, here, I'll give you some of the stats. Pennsylvania's unemployment rate just increased 0.5 point. They're tied for the highest unemployment rate at any of the 50 states in the month of June. They did add 20,300 jobs in June, but they're still 73,200 jobs short of where they were when George Bush took office. And he doesn't have to just make up those 73,000 jobs. They're going to need more than 100,000 or 170,000, actually, to just get level. Because more people have come into the job market. In 3 years, the population of the country grows, right? There are more unemployed Pennsylvanians. There are more discouraged job seekers back in the job market. And the unemployment rate took a stunning leap in June, reports the press. In New Hampshire lost 2,700 jobs in June, the highest percentage job loss in the country. That's not as large a number, but it's a small state. Huge percentage. Largest in all, they'd lost 25,600 manufacturing jobs have gone under Bush. 24.7% of all the manufacturing jobs in the state, a full 25% of all the, more than 24.7% of all the manufacturing jobs in the entire state of New Hampshire have vanished in 3 years of the Bush administration. The Bush administration that openly says, offshoring is wonderful. In fact, we'll tell you how to do it. 29 minutes past the hour.
At last, there's a positive focus on a condition that affects millions. Read The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. John Rady, author of User's Guide to the Brain, says this about The Edison Gene.
Once again, with tireless scholarship and a bit of poetry, Tom Hartman helps take us to the edge of knowing ourselves, our brains, and our world.
The Edison Gene, available in bookstores everywhere.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan, in his semi-annual testimony before the Senate Banking Committee, Greenspan said, "We are creating a problem that has to be addressed." He created a stir when he agreed with Democratic campaign statements that there is a growing gap in wages based on skill level. Greenspan said that upper-level income households have benefited more from the economic recovery than anyone else. He said the effect of increasing concentration of incomes is not desirable in a democratic society. While the Democrats blame President Bush's tax cuts for the disparity, Greenspan blames education.
Pilot salaries at Delta Airlines took a major nosedive on Tuesday after the union was forced to increase its proposed wage cut from 13.5% to 23%. And Delta says that still may not be enough to avoid filing bankruptcy. The airline posted its worst financial record in 25 years and wants pilots to take a 30% cut in wages and, quote, increase their productivity.
On Monday, the U.S. Justice Department gave $500,000 to a Mexican and U.S. coalition for use in fighting the importation of underage sex slaves in Southern California. The Bilateral Safety Corridor Coalition is made up of more than 70 member organizations in both San Diego County and Tijuana, Mexico. The coalition says that young women and boys are lured from Latin America and Eastern European countries to Mexico. They are then trained and sold. Many times they are sent to work in hidden brothels on farms throughout San Diego County where they are forced to service the workers.
Was Dick Cheney doing business with terrorists? Federal prosecutors will put that question to a grand jury this week as they subpoena documents from oil services giant Halliburton regarding its Iranian operations from 1995 through 2000. Cheney was the chief executive at Halliburton during those years while Iran was under sanctions for supposed ties to terrorist activity. Halliburton is facing at least 5 separate investigations for illegal corporate conduct, including bribery in Nigeria, also while Cheney was chief executive.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. According to the Non-Governmental Bureau of National Affairs, unions won 58% of the 1,348 government-monitored workplace elections in 2003, the highest success rate for unions since BNA began watching them some 2 decades ago. Fewer union elections overall were held in 2003 compared to the year before, meaning that while the success rate is growing, the actual number of electoral victories are declining. This corresponds well to shrinking union membership rates in the overall workforce.
You've been listening to WIND, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
It's tit for tat, but heck, you know all that. So when George number one brought in the big guns and chased me out of Kuwait, tried to set me straight, I arranged a little...
Oh, it's the Saddam song.
Texas twit. Well, it didn't quite work.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. No, it didn't work quite right. Quite the way Saddam worked, wanted it to. Our program brought to you today by the Committee for the Advancement of Stem Cell Research. You can find their website at www.cascr.org. The mislead of the day, presidential mislead, in fact. Yes, there's our presidential mislead music. In February, President Bush, now this is back in February, remember when war was polling well and Bush was a war president, George Bush told a national television audience that he would, quote, absolutely, end quote, authorize the release of all records pertaining to his military service after questions had arisen about whether he fulfilled his duty. Days later, the White House claimed it had released everything, with Bush campaign spokesman Terry Holt telling... I guess that in and of itself should make it suspicious. But anyhow, that the documents were, quote, black and white proof that the president served in the National Guard, end quote. But as the Associated Press now reports, the White House had only released partial documentation and has refused to comply with the Associated Press's Freedom of Information Act request for the rest of the public record of George W. Bush's military service records. This is, This is not a liberal activist group, and it's not the Associated Press. Yeah, they have this weird idea that their job is to report the facts. Fox News will tell you black and white proof the president served in the National Guard, but the rest of the media is saying, well, you know, he hasn't shared with us all the documents. He hasn't. I mean, why? Why won't he tell us what's going on? Why won't he share these things with us? I mean, have the presidential records just kind of, you know, fallen into some absolutely strange and distant place? You know, have they gone away? Where might they be? Yes. The other day, the Pentagon reported that the president's records seem to have been inadvertently destroyed. So anyhow, the Associated Press notes that records released so far do not put to rest questions over whether Bush fulfilled his National Guard service for a period during the Vietnam War. That's a verbatim quote from the AP. Just last week, the Pentagon claimed that key records, still not made public, were inadvertently destroyed, as I just told you. While the White House did acknowledge the missing records in February, the Associated Press reports that George W. Bush still refuses to put his signature on the authorization to release copies of the destroyed records. The records of the Pentagon says, sorry, Freedom of Information Act filing. Yes, under the Freedom of Information Act, you do have the right to look at federal documents, including people's service records, or at least the non-confidential parts of them. However, they've been destroyed. Sorry. So it turns out there's a backup copy. There's a backup set that is held in Texas by the Texas Air National Guard. Not, you know, a big surprise after all. That's, you know, George Bush leapfrogged over 320 people, a waiting list that ran as much as 20 months. Leapfrogged over them in 1 week to get into the Texas Air National Guard during the Vietnam War once he became eligible for the draft when he got out of college, because his daddy, Congressman Bush, was able to make it happen. Right? As he said to his professor at Harvard, I had connections. So anyway, this was between school and graduate school. So while the White House did not acknowledge the missing records in February, the Associated Press reports that the president still has not authorized the release of copies of destroyed records that are legally required to exist at the Texas State Archives. Why won't George sign the release? What's he hiding? In its legal brief demanding the president release the documents he promised to release, the Associated Press wrote, quote, a significant ongoing controversy exists over the president's military service during the Vietnam War, especially whether he performed his required service between May and October of 72. Public has an intense and legitimate interest in knowing the facts concerning the president's military service. Reviewing the microfilm copy of the personal file at the Texas Records Center could well answer the questions that have been raised. End quote. The AP also said full disclosure would give the public the whole story and answer questions about, quote, allegations that potentially embarrassing material was removed in 1997 by the Pentagon, of course. Or the Department of Defense. Well, it's all the same thing. So, time will tell. Frankly, I am not holding my breath or sitting around waiting. I mentioned a couple of days ago that, in my opinion, the Georgia election, and I've actually written about this fairly extensively, the Georgia election was one of the more interesting ones in the year 2002. Bev Harris, a reporter who ended up, as a result of this investigation, writing a book called Black Box Voting. She has a website, blackboxvoting.com, was surfing around, Googling around on the Internet and looking for information about Diebold, the voting machine company, which installed the majority of the voting machines in the state of Georgia that were used in the 2002 election and that produced no receipt, no paper trail, no ballot, nothing that you can walk away from the ballot place with and nothing that you can print out, make sure it's right, and put in a box. Everything was zeros and ones. Little electronic pulses and symbols on chips and hard drives and whatnot. That's it. Because an electronic voting machine is nothing more than a fancy computer. And in fact, they run on the Windows operating system. Yeah, for those of you who understand the security implications of that. And so what was interesting about Georgia in particular, when Bev Harris was surfing around the web, she discovered, using the Google search engine, she discovered an FTP site. FTP is an acronym for File Transfer Protocol. An FTP site, it's where you upload files. It doesn't look like a web page. It looks like a file folder. It's like looking at a hard drive. In fact, you are looking at a hard drive. She discovered an FTP site that was owned by Diebold. And it was wide open to the public, no password or anything, and it was right there on the Google search. And so she clicked on it, and she looked into it, and there was a folder called Rob Georgia. I am not making this up. I'm not kidding you. She opened the Rob Georgia folder, and in it were voter records from the state of Georgia from the 2002 election, along with files and programs and a patch that was installed the day or 2 days before the election to update the software, a patch which had not been certified by any election officials. This was apparently illegal. And what was interesting, particularly interesting to me, was that I used to live in Georgia. I lived in Atlanta for 16, 17 years. And so I have some sense of Georgia politics. And all the polls were showing, just before the election, that the Democratic governor was going to win re-election and that the Democratic senator, Max Cleland, a Vietnam veteran who had left his arm, his right arm, and both his legs on the battlefield in Vietnam, who was on the Senate Intelligence Committee, on the Senate Military Services, Military Forces, whatever it's called, committee. I mean, one of the leading experts in the United States on the military. Max Cleland had built a reputation on this for decades. Still is considered one of the leading experts about the military in the United States. Max Cleland was being opposed by a Republican nobody had ever heard of, Saxby Chambliss, who, it turned out, had gotten out of going to Vietnam by claiming that he had a bad knee. He got a medical deferment. Apparently his knee is not bad enough to prevent him from serving in the Senate, but he couldn't serve during Vietnam. And he ran ads, Saxby Chambliss ran ads on TV that showed Max Cleland's face and then morphed it into Saddam Hussein, or into Osama bin Laden's face. And the core of his campaign was that he was more patriotic than was Max Cleland. And people in Georgia were not buying this. I mean, they just weren't buying it. And the polls were showing, just before the election, that Max Cleland was way ahead and that the Democratic governor was way ahead, other Democrats were ahead. And after the election, the day after the election, when the results came in, and they all came in off these electronic voting machines that produced no ballot and no paper trail, no receipt, the results were that the Republicans won by the margins that the polls were showing the Democrats would have won by just a few days before the election. They won the governorship. They won the Senate race. Saxby Chambliss. And I've been saying ever since then, prove to me that this election wasn't stolen. Please. Diebold and other companies. Or, the Secretary of State of Georgia. And nobody can do it. They can't. There is no trail. And that, just people raising questions is a good reason to have a paper trail. I mean, how do you audit an election where there's nothing auditable? Well, you can't. So I've talked about this, I've written about this, and yesterday I got an email from a guy down in Georgia who's actually worked in the, he says, I worked the polls for yesterday's primary election in Georgia and found out something very interesting about the Diebold voting machines. Lamar writes to me. He says they do, in fact, have printers already on them. Now, see, Diebold's argument, the voting machines companies have been saying, we can't attach printers to these machines because it would be too expensive and we'd have to change the software, we'd have to do it. Oh, yeah. Turns out, says my informant, these machines already have printers. He said, weren't we told that adding a printed receipt process to these machines would cause undue hardship on the company and that they would never be able to install printers on these machines in time for this year's elections? Anyway, I thought everyone who is interested in making the election process a fair one should know that this receipt printing technology is not only possible, but already exists. We had to print a report from each machine in the morning before the voting began and after the polls closed in the evening. I guess, says Lamar, we were just lied to yet again by those who are not interested in having fair and accurate elections. Could it be in America? Could it be? 1-866-889-8894. Chuck in New Mexico, you think so?
Yeah, well, you know, first thing, I just found out that you're going to be in Santa Fe here in about a month, and I can't wait to see you.
Great, thank you.
This is going to be great. You know, I'm reminded of a line that Gandhi said. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can appear invincible, but at the end they always fall. And I can't wait for Bush to fall, and I know that history is going to remember him as the worst president that this country, indeed maybe any country, has ever had.
I wouldn't say any country, but certainly.
Well, okay, so there are some third world places, but
yeah, well, even some first world places. I as much as people like to draw parallels between Bush and Hitler, there's really no comparison.
Well, that's absolutely true, but you know, Hitler was elected, wasn't he?
Well, sort of. Actually, what happened was Hitler had a minority. His party was like 20-30%, something like that. And when the Reichstaggebüge, the parliament building, was attacked on February 23rd, as I recall, 1933,
yep.
Hitler was having dinner with von Papp and Hindenburg, the president of the country and the other, whatever he was, prime minister, whatever. And the three of them ran over to the Reichstag building, and Hitler called a press conference, and he had, you know, the press there. Of course, it was just radio in those days. And standing in front of this burning building, he said, he gave this brilliant speech. He said, this is a sign from God. He said, this act of terrorism will not be allowed to stand. Of course, he was claiming it was the communist terrorists, and later that it was the Jewish communist terrorists, you know, these people from the Middle
East. Didn't it turn out that the Nazis actually set fire to it?
Well, there's still a debate about it. There was a book published in Germany just last year suggesting that actually the Nazis didn't have anything to do with it. Sure, in the rise and fall of the Third Reich, says the Nazis did. What we know is that it was a guy named Marius von der Lubbe, who was, as I recall, 28 years old, who was a mentally retarded guy. He was Dutch, and he was in fact a communist. You know, so who knows? But in any case, Hitler turned this thing into, he said it was an act of terrorism, and that Germany had to, you know, respond to this thing, and on the strength of his response to this terrorist bombing of the most important building in the country, Hitler convinced Hindenburg to appoint him as chancellor, and then of course his party got stronger, and then within 4 months after that they passed a law called the Law for the Protection of Patriotic Germans, which was so odious it allowed the police to wiretap and to open people's mail and things, that they put a 4-year sunset provision on it. That was the only way they could get it through Parliament. And that's how Hitler came to power. Anyway, to make a long story short, Chuck, I got to move along here.
Thanks.
Sorry. Thanks for the call, though. Great to hear from you. 10 minutes before the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Uncommon Sense from the Radical Middle. You are in the Democracy Zone.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy?
In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242-8272.
The Founding Fathers thought they'd stop corporations from ever overthrowing elected government. Little did they know that 200 years later, democracy would be stolen and twisted in the name of so-called conservative values. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. The Founders of America fought the Revolutionary War against the excessive corporate power of the East India Company, and presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower warned us that extremely big businesses could destroy democracy. You'll find this extraordinary American story in my book, Unequal Protection: The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with the rampant corruption of the Bush administration. It tells the dramatic story of how corporations hijacked the Bill of Rights, setting the stage for the CEO takeover of America. And it shows how we can take America back and tells the stories of Americans from Pennsylvania to California who are doing just that right now.
Unequal Protection is available in bookstores nationwide. And you can read several chapters online at unequalprotection.com. That's Unequal Protection by Tom Hartman.
Are you or a loved one making too many trips to the bathroom? Listen closely because you're not alone. Over 30 million men suffer from an enlarged prostate. That's why if you make frequent trips to the bathroom, have urgency, hesitancy, or a diminished sex drive, then Super Prostate Formula is for you. It was designed by nationally recognized physician Dr. Michael Toplitsky. The results with his patients have been amazing. Reclaim control now and join the thousands of satisfied customers who have had incredible results with Super Prostate Formula. When you order two bottles of Dr. Toplitsky's Super Prostate Formula, you'll also get two bottles of his Super Libido Formula, an all-natural alternative to Viagra to enhance sexual vitality and performance, plus his book, Complete Guide to Prostate Health, and his newsletter, a total $100 value free as your gift. Guaranteed or your money back. If you're not completely satisfied, return it for a full refund and keep his Libido Formula book and newsletter free as your gift. Not available in stores. Call now. 800-452-0978. 800-452-0978. That's 800-452-0978.
Children who get lots of exercise risk poor health if they breathe polluted air. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. Couch potatoes are in some ways healthier than kids who play soccer, run, or participate in other outdoor sports if they live in areas with high levels of air pollution. Kent Bransford is a medical doctor and a member of Physicians for Social Responsibility, an advocacy group. He cites a recent study of children living in Southern California.
What they did is take children all growing up in the same bad air area, and then they divided them into two groups. One group, very active, playing outside like we probably want our kids to do. So if they were in three or more sports during the year, they were in the active group. And then the other half of the kids were living in the same area but more sedentary. So inside, playing with their Game Boys and PlayStations, etc.
Bransford says the results were surprising.
What was very worrisome is that the children that were outside, active, playing, breathing a lot of air, which children do more so for their body weight than adults, they had about a threefold increase risk of developing asthma compared to the kids who were not as active.
Another recent study looked at California college freshmen. It focused on students who had similar activity levels but compared where they grew up. Bransford says those from Southern California, where smog levels are highest, had more lung disorders than kids from Northern California, where the air is better.
Those college freshmen had decreased lung function studies at age 18, purely related on where they grew up and the air they breathe.
Bransford says air pollution can cause health problems that might last a lifetime. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. 4.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. It's www.greatmystery.org is putting on the talk Friday night. I'll be in Santa Fe August 27th, speaking about We the People, A Call to Take Back America at the Armory for the Arts. And then on Saturday, we're going to be doing a workshop at the Santa Fe Women's Club from 9:30 to 1. And you can get more information by calling 1-800-479-9105. Just as an FYI, Kofi Annan, George Bush has been running around, giving all these speeches over and over and over again, saying that the world is a safer place because of me. Because he attacked Iraq, the world is a safer place, George Bush has been saying. He's been going out of his way to say. Well, Kofi Annan would beg to differ. He says, nope, I'm sorry. The world is not a safer place. The head of the UN. 1-866-889-8894. Cecilia in Winter Park, Florida is on the line. Hey, Cecilia, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am great. We've only got about a minute and a half left, though.
Okay. Real quick. It came out this week. Did you hear down here in Florida that the Secretary of State has had to scrap the felons voter list?
Yes. We reported on that.
Okay. $2 million out the window. Apparently, according to an article in the Miami Herald this week, the state election officials knew about this glitch as far back as 1998. And apparently what they did was that instead
the glitch of... Being, the glitch being that it purged black voters and not Hispanic voters. The Hispanic voters in Miami mostly being Republicans and the blacks mostly being Democrats.
Right. And they basically lumped all the Hispanics with whites.
Right. And didn't purge them. Yeah.
Right. So once again, I am urging people to be very careful about voting down here in Florida. Make it absentee, get it certified, make a copy, and hand deliver it.
Yeah, Cecilia.
Vote to count.
Cecilia, it's not just Florida. The Hamilton County, Ohio, which has twice the black percentage of population from the rest of the state, just purged 110,000 people.
I agree with you.
This is happening.
We have Rush Holt's bill.
Yeah, the Republicans are doing this all across the United States right now. It's not just one state. Cecilia, thank you. Thanks for the call and thanks for listening. Great to hear from you. Thanks to Louise for producing our program today. Thanks to Brad Walrod for our music and to Shelby for streaming us around the planet. Thanks to our sponsors for helping us stay on the air. Thanks to our chat room, the folks in our chat room for showing up. Thanks to Jay for writing and composing our music and Michael Toth and the folks at White Rose Society for our respective archives. Thanks to Ira Gravatt for answering the phone, engineering our program. Thanks to you for listening. We'll see you tomorrow. Same time, same place. Till then, be good.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
While the world seems to be collapsing around us, there is hope. Tom Hartman's inspiring book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late, has just been re-released. The new updated version is available now and offers solutions to the issues that concern us most: eco-damage, genetic engineering, virulent disease, the end of cheap oil, water shortages, global famine, wars. We can still do something about it and create a world that will work for us.